Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! This evening's going to be kind of a hybrid sort of affair. It's Tuesday. It's not Wednesday. But I won't be here tomorrow evening. I will, in fact, be attending something called a Dismantling Racism Workshop. And I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it a lot. It'll take up my whole day tomorrow and half of the day on Thursday. But I should be back for the show by Thursday evening. Cross your fingers. But with that in mind, we can do some prayer meeting stuff tonight. Tuesday, the minister of music has the night off, so we won't do the usual music thing. But you're welcome to bring any religious insanity that you might care to bring to the table, as well as anything else that might get under your saddle or be in your bonnet. You know the drill. That's the plan, at least, for this evening. But I want to start, if you don't mind, since we've had a good deal of economic discussion from the inimitable Guy James, as well as Mark Levine in the last hour with that odious cretin, Mike Lane. Lord of mercy. That man brings out the absolute worst in me. Can't imagine. And yet you heard it there again. I noted it in the chat room at the time. You heard Mike Lane arguing that somehow it's the UAW's fault for making sure that their retirees' health care plans are 100% paid. Arguing that that's a bad thing. See, I'm just weird. I don't think that anybody, I think we ought to have universal health care. I think it ought to be taken care of on the front end. Does that make any sense? I mean, we're talking about retired people, people with fixed limited incomes, and that creepy little Republican thinks that more money needs to be taken out of their pockets? Screw him. You know, the UAW didn't get it wrong. The UAW got it right. Everybody else is getting it wrong. That's what I was talking about last night in terms of arguing lower wages instead of higher ones. Anyone who works for a living, who among us needs less money and not more? And that yet there are those godless, soulless Repiglicans arguing that working people are making too much money. It only goes to prove to me that godless, soulless, motherless Repiglicans are so divorced from reality and so divorced from anything approaching working class in this country that they simply have no comprehension whatsoever of what a working class life is. I know what a working class life is. I grew up in one. And I have lived in one. And that's what we have now. It's the holiday season. And we do try to mark them. We don't do a lot of religious claptrap around them. But we mark them. We have tiny babies in the house. And you make a big to-do out of Christmas time for little babies. Because when they're little is a time when their innocence should be fostered and cherished. And so, and you know, the youngest of those are the grandkids, the grandbabies. The youngest of Agnes and my babies, the youngest one's 11 now. But Christmas is still a magical time. And, you know, as we've discussed before, we have these celebrations at this time of year because it's otherwise, frankly, rather dreary and hard and, yes, depressing. And there's nowhere in the Northern Hemisphere, with the possible exception of the tropics, where it isn't. It just is. Rome at this time, 2,000 years ago, was a dreary place this time of year. Athens hasn't much to recommend it in December either. Nor even does a place like Jerusalem, or Damascus, or Baghdad. So, you know, the cultures mark this time of year because it's also hopeful, because here in a few days we will reach the shortest day of the year, and every day thereafter will be infinitesimally longer until we work our way up to June 21st, when they start getting shorter again. So we mark that. It's a visceral connection between humans and their natural world. And, of course, it's all turned upside down for someone like our buddy John Fox, who lives sometime tomorrow in the future in Australia. But that doesn't change the natural relationship. I know, but I know. The fact of the matter is, we're not doing a lot of holiday here. For something like 15 years, we've done we've built a family tradition around the Christmas meal. Even when my father laid in the hospital dying, for the sake of the rest of the family, we still did the traditional Christmas meal. We won't do that this year. We just won't. We can't, because we're working class, and we live in Bushmerica. So, I understand these things, and you understand these things. The Corkers and Coburns and Demented's and Shelby's and the Mushmouth Jill Sessions, they haven't a clue. Utterly divorced from the reality of what it is to be an American, and engaged in the age-old, most hateful piece of politics this country knows, and that is the attempt to divide one group of working people from another group of working people. And with that having been said, I go to an email that reached us from our buddy Scott in Sweden. He says, hey, Bob. A quarter of a century ago, in Reagan's brand new morning in America, when I still lived in the U.S. of A., my first job as a graduating Master of Arts in Economic Geography, with a concentration in analytic methods, was at the Kansas Department of Economic Development, KDED, K-E-D-D, K-D-E-D, which, when pronounced KDED, came rather close to the truth. We few academic types entered with visions of plumbing the depths of sugar plum economic databases, waving our magic wands of factor analyses and multiple regression equations, and deriving formulas of finding unmet potential to transmogrify the little local actors into somewhat bigger local, or dare we hope, regional actors with judicious dollops of seed money, economic analyses, small business counseling, and other reasonable hoop-de-doo, which for some strange reason seems, well, suspect in much of America. An aside, late one spring, Topeka once spiffied its main avenue downtown with some new flagpoles and nice fire engine red flags. Just to be a bit of a jerk, I suppose, although at the time I thought it was simply clever, I called City Hall and thanked them with a pseudo-Russian accent for fine tribute to working man of America on the May Day. And wouldn't you know it, the idiots actually forever took down all the flags within a couple of hours and replaced them a few weeks later with American flags. Let no man accuse Kansan officialdom of c'est la vie. Or whatever that also happens to be in Russian. Well, back to KDED. We ran our analyses, identified potential growth companies and even industries, and then presented it to the state legislature, who took it, turned it left, then right, squinted, held it up to the light, and asked, what sort of inkblot test is this here? We had a few top-name professionals come down and try to explain the findings in layman's terms, but the message they really sent us was, we ain't doing nothing we don't understand, and this here we don't understand. Too much mathematics. You try to make us look dumb or what, showing off? And where's our contributors in all this? It is, after all, Republican-controlled Kansas. Back when it was becoming, remember the time frame. This is back when Kansas was becoming what would later become the subject of What's the Matter with Kansas. This is when What's the Matter with Kansas was becoming What's the Matter. That's my editorial comment, not Scott's. So the word came down from the hidey-ho that since Georgia and Texas and Florida were having success at attracting Rust Belt industries to the Sun Belt, and as we were the Sunflower State, that must mean we were a Sun Belt state too. So now we were to forget all that computer stuff and identify companies up north willing to come here. And, of course, the pot was to be sweetened with tax breaks, free utilities, free access roads, low-interest building loans, and all the other easy-to-understand pork, even in cattle country. About a year later, a whiff of late 20th century accidentally blew into the State House, and some go-getter decided that each agency needed feedback from the staff. Hee-haw! I breathlessly exclaimed. The worker ants will have their say! How? Second aside, now in Sweden, where I currently live and where the worker ants are much more or less in charge, this process is carried out with questionnaires, small meetings with the union reps, brainstorming, setting aside research time, and so forth. But back at KDED, the process was a wee bit different. They ushered us into a large room where we ringed the concrete brick wall, feeling every bit like potential firing squad targets, while the head honcho, the lieutenant governor, and the big hidey-ho himself stood across from us. First a speech about doing one's job faithfully, then another about devotion to the chosen strategy, and finally the much-awaited big question was growled.
So, does anyone have anything to say?
Silence. Even from the crickets there was silence. After a painful eternity and the smug grins appeared across the room from the ants, I meekly lifted my middle right arm. A sweet, you there, yes, from the hidey-ho himself. Well, the silence broken only by my knocking knees, isn't what we're asking these companies up north to do is to sell out one set of American workers just to come down here and hire another set at lower pay while our taxpayers sweeten the deal, and then after they've milked that dry, then go to Arkansas or Missouri and do it all again and again and again? Isn't this actually worse than a zero-sum game? Because not only do the wages go down, but they don't pay as much in taxes as we pay them with ours, and the profits all go out of state, and after they split, we have to do it again? Paint-peeling silence. But having just been preemptively fired via honcho's glare and walking this far down the plank already, my youthful self saw glory in martyrdom. There was only one thing left to say. So why aren't we talking about distribution of wealth anyway? Why does whatever we do only seem to favor out-of-state owners for factories or malls or agribusiness? Wouldn't it be better to lift regular Kansans up and let them compete with the out-of-staters so the money would stay here in local banks, get lent back out to other locals? And my voice trailed off as my survival instincts interpreted the color of Heidi Ho's face to mean, "Nuff said." My more eloquent friend, Dave, we'll call him Dave, decided he really must have inwardly wanted other employment as he took up the ball and advanced it a few hard yards up the gut, which prompted, you know, you gotta love any American expatriate living in Sweden who can still pull out a great Midwestern Big Ten football analogy like advancing the ball a few hard yards up the gut. Man, this ain't no belly play. This is a fullback right behind the center plowing for that 3 yards in a cloud of dust. Editorial comment over. Advanced it a few hard yards up the gut, which promptly ended the meeting way ahead of time. That afternoon, damn near every other fellow bureaucrat snuck into my room to shake my hand and furtively whisper, "I'm so glad you said that," or, "I've been thinking that too," or other some ex post facto tidbit encouragement, which for once was really not better late than never. But they all had families. So, Bob, and my fellow hornies, what this showed me was that even the bulk of the people implementing these idiot policies may not believe in them, yet they fear speaking up. America has become a nation not of worker ants, but the three monkeys. See no evil, speak no evil, and hear no evil. And that, of course, is our buddy Scott in Stockholm. You know, I think, with Scott's permission, I'm going to forward this on for posting on the Horn blog, because this is too good just for have me sitting here reading it to you the one time. Chew on this a little bit. Remember, this is back in the heady days of Morning in America. And political ads with bears walking in the woods, where I would expect bears to be walking. They're a hell of a lot better in the woods than they are on Wall Street, aren't they, friends and neighbors? So, enjoy it. It will go up on the blog. Okay, Scott, you're not listening right now because it's the middle of the night in Stockholm, and I really wouldn't expect you to. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make an executive decision here. And let's see. Yeah. All right. And please post to blog. Thanks, Bob. P.S. Pull all personal references, please. There. Done. Because for that, and you know, Scott got this because Scott worked on the ground with this stuff. If you want to see it laid out for you in just all of its sickening, shameful race to the bottom of the barrel glory, by all means, go to your local library. They might have it. Or go to goodjobsfirst.org. Or any of the, hey, you know, we've got a portal to Amazon.com on the website. You could go through that. And if you purchase the book via Amazon, I think we get 0.573298276 cents out of the transaction. Order Greg LeRoy's The Great American Jobs Scam. Because you see, among other things, what these companies do is they put these so-called factory jobs up for bid. They bid it out, just like if you were going to build a barn or a house or an office complex. They bid it out to the states, and then the states, in a form of civil war, it is what it is, in a form of civil war, sit there and bid back and forth with these auto manufacturers and various other foreign manufacturing firms to see who can rip off their taxpayers the most profoundly. Here in West Virginia, for instance, We ripped off our taxpayers to create a great big retail space on top of a hill in Wheeling, West Virginia. And it was going to bring high quality businesses. We got a Cabela's that gets a tax break. You know, Cabela's that sells, you know, hunting gear and stuff like that. They get and has some stuffed bears and trout hanging on the wall. And they get a tax break for being a museum because they've got stuffed bears and trouts hanging on the wall. And they don't pay the same tax rate as other businesses selling the same kind of gear. So it, of course, served to put a local businessman out of work because he didn't need to be running his own local business sports shop, bringing in locals to do business with locals and keeping the money in town. No, by God, he needed to shutter his doors, declare bankruptcy, and go to work for minimum wage for freaking Cabela's. Hooray, capitalism. Oh, the free market. Free market, my butt. Nothing free in that. And there's nothing free in Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia declaring war on another manufacturing sector of this country. And that's what it is, because a great deal of this happens in the South. Now, I know a lot of northern folk and a lot of folk whose folks came here after, say, that little dust-up that ended in 1865. Say, you southerners, you spend too much time thinking about that civil. Get over it! Shh, newsflash. They ain't getting over it. They're winning. Mary, a shot fired. But what did I hear growing up? The South will rise again, by God. Somebody whistle Dixie. They're winning. And instead of relatively honorable, decent, I know we're talking about generals, but we're also talking about a different age, relatively honorable, decent people like Robert E. Lee, or Albert Sidney Johnston, who bled to death in his own boot, making sure that Yankee soldiers got tended to first. Rather than those kinds of people, you've got rapacious thugs like Jeff Sessions and John DeMelded, and that just bug spray crazy. Yeah, oh man, bring that plastic bag in the decon again. I gotta huff some more. This is great. Tom Coburn. And chinless Mitch McConnell. Those are the generals leading the southern assault on the nation this time. And once again, it's shock troops are people who were inadequately paid in the first place, just like the boys in Butternut marching in with rags wrapped around their feet instead of shoes and stomping the guts out of the Yankees at every turn. Were people who were poorly paid in the first place and about whom their betters, Lord, they wouldn't speak on the street. Well, I don't talk to that kind of people unless I'm forming up a wave of them and ordering them to march into a hail of grape. It's the same thing all over again. And this time I don't know if we have the sheer weight of numbers to beat them back. That is just the simple truth of it. So that's where we begin. And what a beautiful email, Scott. Thank you very much. And I'm going to go to the phones in just a minute, but I want to finish the thought. Because if there is any good to be taken out of these Repiglican shenanigans, it is this. And I put this in the form of a question. Are we finally done with ever letting the Repiglican Party get away with calling itself the party of business ever again? That little light went on for me earlier this afternoon when I heard my comrade, Guy James, read a letter from an auto dealer that is making the rounds of the internets and so forth. A letter from an auto dealer, the owner of a Ford dealership in Elkins, West Virginia. and it was factual, it was well written, and it was blunt, and it gave me plenty of things to think about. It should be published, frankly, if it hasn't already, on a full page of the New York Times. More particularly, it should be published in a full page in the Birmingham News, the Mobile Press Register, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, I don't know, the Columbia, South Carolina Moral Volcano and Battle Cry of Freedom. It should be published in the Lexington Herald Leader in Kentucky. It should be published in Arkansas for the benefit of what's her name, Blanche Lincoln, the one of the mugwump Democrats who sided with these godless, soulless, motherless, working class, despising repiglickens. And it laid out, it put paid to so many of the lies that the Shelbys and the Sessionses and the Demented's and the Corkers. Now, let's not forget the Nashville Tennessean needs to be published there. Memphis Commercial Appeal needs to be published there. Corkers and Lamar Alexanders and the Coburns and so I don't know what they call the Oklahoma Morning Chicken Scratch or what and you know Bugle of Justice whatever. It needs to be published there for people to read and understand. But I also can't help wondering, and since the guy is in West Virginia, I'm not going to default that he's one of them, but I can't help wondering how many Chevy dealers, how many Ford dealers, how many Pontiac, formerly Oldsmobile, how many Lincoln Mercury dealers? How many Cadillac dealers? How many Chrysler, Dodge, and once upon a time, Plymouth dealers have gone to the polls every time they opened, whether they needed to vote or not, and pulled that lever, punched that card, filled in that dot, or touched that screen for the Republican candidate because the auto dealership owner said that voting Republican is good for business. Well, that day is over. That day has damned well passed. In seeing the destruction of 2 to 3 million jobs, if in fact that is all we lose because of the chicanery, because of the treachery of the likes of Demented and McConnell, of Sessions and Shelby, of Corker and Alexander, and on and Coburn. Because of their treachery, for once, those people who have gone and voted Republican year after year, election after election, are finally going to have to confront the reality that their beloved party of Lincoln is not good for business. Business blossomed under Bill Clinton. Business will blossom again under Barack Obama. But at the close of the Reagan-Bush years and at the close of these 8 tortured years, we find an economy practically, if not actually, in ruins. And the Republican Party is good for business is a dead letter, at least by my reckoning. What about yours? Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Brother Bob.
Hey, Luke, what's happening, man?
You talked about that war of northern aggression earlier. Yes, indeedy. Oh, I tell you what. You know, it's one of them things. It's like I say, I still want somebody to, one of the new big newspapers ought to do just a big old expose listing all the southern senators and how much money they pulled off for all these foreign-owned car companies down this way.
You know, I think we may, at some point, we may see that, Luke.
You know, it's just interesting to see that whenever we see Mr. Vitter or Mr. Corker or Mr. Shelby stand up, that somebody didn't stand up going, and how much money do you get for Toyota? How much money do you get for Honda? How much money do you get for BMW?
It's all there in black and white. You know, that's we've talked about. You know, I've read that list, and Guy James did today as well. Makes it 3 days now. It's going to begin to sink in that the Corkers and the Alexanders and the Dements and so forth are acting strictly and solely out of their own self-interest.
Oh yeah. Well, I saw today that apparently Too Stupid to Eat a Pretzel got interviewed today by Miss Crowley on CNN. Apparently was into total revisionist mode. Everything's just perfect the way I did it. Yeah. Just the world didn't match up to me. And he said he wants Brother Jeb to run for the Senate. All I got to say is everybody take off a shoe. We got work to do.
I know.
It's sort of, couldn't you have been wearing boots, mister? Why'd you have
steel-toed boots? You know, I think they're a little harder to throw, but they're aerodynamically more sound.
Well, if you get them to do the spin, it does so much better for them.
Yeah, they boomerang you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or if you throw two together, just tie the laces.
But at this point in time, the fact of the matter is, Luke, as I noted last night, I'm at the point where I think it's time to start throwing some work boots at Corker and Shelby and Sessions and DeMint and McConnell and Coburn and that crowd.
Oh, I'll tell you the fun argument going on down here right now. They just started talking about it in the paper. Is our governor is term limited, so his next cycle around he can't run. So they're trying to decide. Republicans are deciding who they want to run on their side. They can't decide whether Frist wants to come back and run.
Oh mercy! I hadn't even contemplated that. You just ruined my night.
Or Zach Wump, man who sounds like he's got a mouthful of grits.
Name included.
Yeah, I mean you hear him. It's like say I know I've got an accent, but dear Lord Almighty.
Zach Wump?
Wump.
You're lying. You're kidding. What? No, there is no such individual on God's green planet.
Congressman Zach Wump, Z-A-C-H-W-A-M-P, represents the 3rd District.
That just makes my little head hurt. I hate that. I hate that.
It really hurts.
Well, and then the thing is, you guys had a passing fair decent Democratic governor.
Oh, yeah.
But your brother and sister Tennesseans went to the polls to make sure that he couldn't get anything accomplished.
Well, I tell you what, I think I told you this last time we talked about that, you know, I figure it's about like the Congress, you know. I figure about 2 years of GOP running the state house, and they'll get voted out and not be back in for another 20. Because I figure they'll screw it up bad enough just in two. Because they were already talking about, well, we're going to make sure they don't pass no state income tax. It's like, we ain't talked about one in a long time, but for some reason they want to talk about it. You know, there are some people that talk about it, but you know what I mean. It ain't no major thing down this way. But, oh, no, we can't have no state income tax. Oh, I tell you what.
Because, you know, that was supposedly part of the reason that, you know, Nissan and Saturn located in South Central Tennessee.
And while we're getting the Volkswagen.
Right, but
beautiful Chattanooga.
Okay, but I got a real stupid question, Luke. You guys don't have I'm full of them. I really am full of a lot of stuff. Just ask any right winger. Where's the $577 million to pay Volkswagen coming from if y'all don't have a tax base?
We've been trying to figure that out, you know.
I mean, I know that beautiful, beautiful Tennessee State Capitol building sits up there on that rise above the Cumberland River in Nashville. Have y'all got a money factory underneath that thing?
We figure they're just digging stuff out of the ground. We don't know what it is, but maybe David can sometime call in and give you a better idea on that. Our biggest thing around here, like say, you know, is we of course have a high sales tax. You know, we got like a 7.75% sales tax. And, you know, they get it out of us the other direction. It's the same thing. It's just, you know, they get you out of it one way, and then they come around and go, oh, well, we want to get rid of the sales tax. And you're going like, well, fine, what are you going to pay with? And that's when you get the people that want to get rid of the sales tax, or you're the people that don't want to have an income tax.
And yet, you know, the funny thing is, if you had an income tax, that sales tax might not be so high. And the fact of the matter is, income taxes are supposed to be progressive, whereas the sales taxes are regressive. And just about anybody making any sort of a decent living wage would wind up on the better end of the stick with the income tax.
I know. Oh, but boy, you used to do that, and boy, they set them people loose in Nashville, and they go up there, and they virtually circle the state capitol with cars blowing horns, literally. They've done that before. We've had our local, you know, one of our local right wing radio hosts. He goes over to Nashville when they talk about it. I mean, stirs up the crowd. Oh, you know, I mean, that's
idiots. Idiots.
Oh yeah.
Plum idiots.
I know. But let's see, it's going to something else, something more interesting. Let's see, which one today? Like I say, I did see in his interview where he did talk about that he wants Jebby to run for Senate.
I saw that, and I'm still trying to keep dinner down from the very thought of it. But, you know, he won't. It won't say Jeb Democrat, Jeb Republican. It won't say Jeb Bush. It'll just say Jeb.
Yeah.
Just like those signs back at the 2004 ConCon in New York City that I saw that were hastily removed from the camera's view that said Jeb 08.
Uh-huh. Well, you know how it is. They'll do that the same way that, you know, was it 04 they just had the W? Like I think they tried to do it, so they said most people won't know what it means. Just put W up there.
I know, and I want my H the President sticker so bad because that'll just drive the wingers nuts. I mean, I've seen news stories where they're having hissies over the fact that he's decided he is going to use his full name for being sworn in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's something that the boys over at Fox News were just absolutely having a fit over. How dare they? Well, I saw the other thing today. I think they said that the CNN saying that they think on Wednesday he'll announce Bill Sack, you know, the Iowa governor, as his agricultural secretary. And if I'm not mistaken, that gives him like two secretaries to go. And so by the end of the year, he'll already have his cabinet ready, named and ready to go.
Yeah, with the single exception that for some reason or another, the Democrats in the majority in the Senate are letting the Republicans call the shots on when they're going to do their confirmation hearings.
I know. It's like, say, Harry, can you step down and let's find somebody with a spine, please?
Yeah, well, you feel that knotty thing in the middle of your back, Harry? Oh, you don't have one, do you, Harry? Oh, sorry, my bad.
You know, it's like saying, you know, let's get somebody in there. I mean, shoot, I'm at the point right now, put Levin or somebody in there. At least he argues well.
Durbin!
You know?
Durbin! He's second in command anyway. And I've actually heard that he's a fundamentally decent human being.
Well, you know, it's like you were talking a minute ago, you know, so it's like saying, I'm sorry, but after 15, 20 years, I'm tired. If I hear a Democrat say, we can work with the Republicans, no, we can't. We've learned that. We turn the other cheek, they kick it.
Well, you and I have learned that, but we don't sit there and, you know, we're not on the stair-stepping machine or the ski machine sitting there working out in the Capitol gym, the Senate gymnasium next to some insane freak who thinks that the earth is, you know, 6,000 years old.
I mean, and these are some of the crazy, and some, on our side, some of the crazy fools that when they got rid of Stevens, they stood up and gave him a standing ovation.
Yep.
I'd have been down there helping him with his bags, going, here, we'll get you out of here. Come on.
Yeah, don't let the door hit you, you know, where
the good Lord split you.
You're right.
But, you know, it's just.
But they're collegial in the Senate.
You know, I'm to the point now, it's sort of like the thing, it's sort of like the thing said a few years ago, said, I want somebody from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party to represent.
Yeah, that was Howard Dean.
Howard Dean. Mind blocked on that. Sorry about that.
That's okay. It happens to me all the time.
But you know what I mean? I want somebody out there that, you know, that ain't going to just sit there and look down at their navel. It's like, no, you look them in the eye and dare them to blink. You know, it's like, you guys want to do a filibuster? You go right ahead. Let's see what happens when the people, you know, on something really good for the whole of the people. Let's see you all convince all of your Republicans, because we know we got a couple up in the Northeast that when their people start ringing their phone off the hook, are going to think about it real hard. You know, like I say, I'm just waiting till Obama pushes one of his first things through and Mitch McConnell raises up on his hind legs and says, we're going to filibuster this. And then we're going to look at people like Olympia Snow and go, are we?
I know. And,
like I say, now I ain't going to look down at the navel. We're going to make look them right in the eye and just go, say, answer or turn away, but you ain't going to just stand there and just do nothing. I mean, it's, I'm
but sorry. The question, though, Luke, is how do we accomplish that?
Well, like I say, I'm really hoping, you know, who I actually think is going to be interesting if it happens, is if we get Brother Franken in there. I have a feeling he'll ask those kind of stupid questions. You know, he's the one that wants, I don't think he'd be afraid to ask that kind of question.
Well, I'd say, somebody's got to, and frankly, somebody's got to get really serious with these people.
I mean, you know, it's one of these things. It's like, gang, look, y'all sat on your hind end for the last 10, 12 years, and, you know, you've let the Republicans run us right up to the edge of the cliff. It's like, no, time to put this puppy in reverse. We're going to turn around and find another road. You know, I mean, this idea we're going to jump the cliff. It's like, no, I'm sorry, evil. We're not going to try it, Mr. Knievel. You know, I bet we can find us a good road, you know, that leads us to a place where we're all happy.
Well, what
a greasy spot on the ground.
I mentioned collegiality a little bit ago. I'm tired of it. I don't want to see any Democrat ever refer to Tom Coburn or Jim DeMint or any of those others that I mentioned as my dear esteemed colleague or my good friend, the senator from or no. I want open contempt. I want plainly spoken disgust, disdain.
You know, it's one of those things. It's like say I want them to look at the guy and say, "Look, this is nuts." It's like you know, it's what was the old thing that it's in one of the. About World War II, when the Japanese first attacked.
Oh, I fear we have awakened a sleeping giant and filled him with.
The thing where FDR was talking to Cordell Hull and said, "I want you to, you know, when he asked how did you receive them," and Cordell Hull was an ex-Tennessee, and he said he used a little bit of back mountain language on.
Yeah.
So it's time to quit playing nice. It's time to start slapping some cheeks.
Yeah, some really good middle English.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, like I say, we've played nice long enough, now we're playing to win. You know, we're over this dancing, you know, it's all we're out there doing is sort of, you know, swirling around each other. It's time to take the lead. Quit just playing, you know, quit letting somebody lead you around in a circle. Well, but I'm going to let you go. I know you got more people there lining up.
Well, I appreciate it, Luke, and, you know, are you right, just out of curiosity, are you writing to Corker, writing to Lamar Alexander, and telling him that you know, there's at least one good liberal Tennessee, well, we know there's several, but that objects to the way that they're trying to further divide this country?
I sent an email, you know, just simply said, you know, give this up. I mean, you know, it's like, say, if you knock down Detroit, then you're just knocking yourself down and all of us with it. Because, you know, once the parts manufacturers start collapsing, guess what? They're the parts manufacturers for both sides, for both the GM and Ford, and also for the Toyota and the Nissans. Said, I want to see them build a car without brakes on it or without a steering wheel.
And the thing is, they're even admitting it now.
Yeah.
You know, the Japanese manufacturers aren't saying, oh, well, you know, we'll just pick up the slack. They know that they're going to get crippled.
Mm-hmm. Because like I say, if they drive the wrong company out of business, when a third or a quarter or even a half of their business disappears, some of these companies that build the parts are going to have to say bye, and then Toyota's going to be looking around going, well, we got to buy these from who?
Yeah,
that was the only manufacturer.
So it's not going to be anywhere near as easy as some might have us think. I have a feeling
they're just spotting their own nose. All right, bud.
All right, Luke, you have a good night, brother. We'll talk to you soon. Bye now. Seems easy enough to comprehend by my lights, but apparently it's too hard. We understand that dinosaurs and Repiglick and senators each have a brain about the size of an acorn, so, you know, why is anybody surprised? Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Juanita.
Hey, Juanita.
poor Elizabeth.
What happened? Did her little head explode finally?
Well.
Or did it go round and round like she'd been possessed?
She had a bone to pick with Bush.
Oh, did she?
And I thought, well, what is this? Well, she didn't get her annual invitation to the Christmas party at the White House.
Oh, bless my soul.
But she said it wouldn't last long. I was thinking, what in the world is she going to say?
Well, you know, I'm guessing she won't be on the, well, I don't know, maybe he's a classier man than that. I was going to say, I'm guessing she's not going to be on Barack and Michelle's list, neither.
On the what?
On Barack and Michelle's Christmas list, either.
I will hope not. You know, he's got that nice streak, but I just hope that he'll do, you know, what Luke said. I'm like you. I'm so tired of hearing the honorable, my honorable friend, or my, it's almost like, I don't know, it's just disgusting.
Yeah, I'd like to address these remarks to that no good, contemptuous, lower than a snake's belly in a wagon rut son of a reverend from Alabama.
I used to like it when some of them would get into a big argument. You know, we had a guy from here in Tampa, war hero, and I can't think of his name, but shoot. He'd get mad. You know, he went from, he worked his way up. He was a war hero, and he worked his way up in Florida Congress and then went on up to the representative and then a senator.
Bob Graham?
No.
Okay.
No, Bob Graham, I don't think this guy, he'd get so mad, he would be hollering. And I love that. I mean.
Lawton Childs? No.
No. Uh-uh. He didn't get that. He didn't, I don't think he's ever been governor. But anyhow, I want him to take up for us, we the people. That's what I want. That's why I've been saying that for a long, long time.
And I honest to God don't know if they will.
Apparently
we haven't made enough noise yet.
Apparently not. We haven't thrown enough shoes.
Or steel-toed work boots.
You know, Buzz Flash has got where he can ride in and say what we could do that represents our country.
Mm-hmm.
Because throw the shoes, you know, is
right.
From over there, overseas. But boy, people are really, gung-ho for what that man did.
And you know, you do know there are reports out now that say that he has been beaten, that he has had bones broken, that he has internal injuries now.
Oh, I can believe it. Oh, but Bush has forgiven him. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Well, maybe he has forgiven him now that he's had a good dose of righteous punishment.
Yeah, and they got it on film.
Did you see the photograph today of Dana Perineal with her little war wound?
No.
Oh, yeah, it's over, it was either Think Progress or Crooks and Liars. Close-up photos of her. She took one right in the right eye. She got whacked with a microphone in the eye when the scuffle ensued.
Yeah.
She got a big old shiner and some sort of weird square splotch over her right eyebrow. And Agnes looked at the photograph and said she needs to pay somebody to do a better job of waxing, too. But, you know, the close-ups are hell. And Agnes is catty sometimes. But, she's got a big old mouse under her right eye, and it looks like she got whacked real good.
For that. Where did you see that?
Like I said, either at thinkprogress.org or crooksandliars.com.
Yeah.
It was part of her spin out today. You know, if I spun like she spins, I'd buy tires every 2 weeks. But her spin out today said we are not. She was arguing with Helen Thomas again. You know, losing proposition. And she said she told Helen Thomas, we are not occupiers of Iraq. We are there as guests.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure, we attacked them and we took over, but we're just guests.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what I do when I'm a guest. I go in heavily armed and bomb two or three bedrooms and tell people that I'll leave when I damned well feel like it.
Yeah.
And then sit down on the sofa and wait for a sofa agreement.
I got another thing that you said something about this was going to take the place of church night.
Well, prayer meeting. Yeah, prayer meeting.
Prayer meeting, yeah. Okay. Do you think it's too late that Rick Warren can give Blagojevich a peace prize before he gets impeached?
Well, sadly, the Blagojevich is the wrong party. He won't be getting any prizes from Rick Warren. Rick Warren only gives his prizes to Rick Higley. I know you are. I know you are.
I mean, this guy's got a foul mouth, but doesn't our president?
Our president has a real nasty potty mouth.
Uh-huh. And I don't think this guy probably would like to have that kind of a power, but I don't think he's got a chance now. I don't think he's done as bad. But, you know, if they don't do something about, that was another thing a lot of people wrote in on that, about the shoe thing, is they'd be satisfied to see him in prison. Somebody even wrote they wanted to do him like they did Mussolini.
Ooh, that's...
Yeah.
I have to be careful what I say, Juanita.
Oh, yeah.
I don't want any of those humorless guys with narrow lapels and skinny black ties and little things coming out of their ears coming and not finding what we're saying here funny.
Did you read that letter I sent you, that thing where they sent the... Where they're gonna... Where she sent a letter to Shelby?
Yes.
Was it Shelby or the other one?
I believe it was Senator Shelby.
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty good letter.
Yeah, about boycotting Alabama?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's a full-on movement that was started up in Michigan, and that'd be tough on me because I don't get down there very often or anything, but my very favorite sausage in the entire world, like I need to be eating sausage, comes out of Greenville, Alabama. A little brand called Kaneka. You may have heard Kate talking about it last Friday because she likes to torment me over the name.
I didn't know what she was talking about, but I know they used to have some really good stuff up in Georgia, too.
But, you know, I don't think that's inappropriate calling for an Alabama boycott because frankly, Alabama and Tennessee and South Carolina and Mississippi and the like have already fired their initial shots in this. It's, as usual, shot gets fired at Fort South Carolina's got to have a hand in any trouble we make. I'm sorry to the liberal South Carolinians, but dadgummit, that's how it shakes out.
Yeah. Okay, well, I guess I'll let you go, and you have a good, what do you call it, seminar?
Yeah, tomorrow? Yeah, we'll call it, it's a seminar.
That sounds really interesting.
It should be, and I'm really looking forward to it. I think it'll be an uplifting experience.
I think a lot of those things should be in school, too. You know, from the time they're little, because a lot of prejudice is just misunderstanding. Not all of it.
And a lot of it's taught in the home and has to be countered somewhere else. And in this, you know, you can't expect it to be countered down at the local Southern Baptist Church or anywhere such as that. So it's got to be countered somewhere, and the school is as good a place as any.
You know, the last Southern Baptist church I attended, they had their new church and their old church.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what the old church became for a while?
What's that?
The black church. They did not have the same church together.
Oh, no, the Southern Baptist church was founded.
And they were like, you know, in the same lot. I mean, the same, you know, area.
Yeah.
Piece of land.
Yeah. That's not at all unusual, though, because the Southern Baptist Church was founded out of a deep-seated desire to make sure that they didn't have to worship with any people of the wrong skin pigment by their determination.
Right. I can believe it. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think Carter finally left because of that.
I didn't know that, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
That's what I believe reason. It hadn't been that long ago. I guess he just didn't give up for a while, and they just got worse and worse. I think they are worse than they used to be. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, I know that the last time I was down at the one that I grew up in, I was told rather proudly by a member of the church, we even have a black couple now. Mm-hmm. We do.
Yes.
And, you know, boy, I'm so proud for you. It's only been 140 years.
Yeah. I know that the church that I started attending, you know, they had black people going, and, I mean, it was integrated. And one of my neighbors, an older lady, she went with me. She said, oh, is they allow them in here? Gosh.
Mercy.
It's terrible.
It makes you want to bawl sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Okay, well, you
all
have
right.
A good evening.
Take care, Juanita.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. From Central Florida, our View correspondent, Juanita, and onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Ed.
How are you doing this evening?
Oh, I'm getting along, I reckon. Just trying to sort all this out. I'm not sure how long you've been on hold, but are we finally done letting Republicans claim that they care about business?
Well, the thing that's discouraging to me, I got on when the last fella called, and that's been my theme all the time, that, you know, about you knew as a snake when you picked me up. You know what I told you about that?
Yep.
And if the Democrats don't get off of their stupid hind ends and realize that they're dealing with somebody that's not movable at all, then...
Well, it reminds me, I'm no MacArthur fan, but it reminds me of MacArthur's strategy in the South Pacific. There's some places that you just don't want to waste any time on, so you isolate them, you starve them out, and you go around them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we got to do with these repig lickins. And frankly, Ed, I know it wasn't likely to happen before the inauguration, but I tell you what, the minute we get this new majority in the Senate, I am with Wayne 100%. Nuclear option, don't talk about it, nothing, don't want a bunch of discussions on the Sunday shows, just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Bring somebody up who stands up and makes the motion to eliminate the filibuster, vote on it, and have done, and tell them we'll put it back when you people start behaving again.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to do that. Look at how they're fighting, and just listen to their shows now. Old Bill Bennett and Steve O'Brien and all of them. I mean, they're as tenacious on what they believe, and they don't recognize that they're a loser. You know, how can they call any shots? They're in a minority, and they should be treated like that. They lost. You know, they had their shot. They run it in the ground. And I'd say upper giggy with a 10-foot pole or something. That's the way I feel about it. I'm not in this reaching across the aisle. I've said it before on to you. That stinks. That's the reason. That's why have we got, if we're going to do that, why have we got two parties if we're going to be friendly? I'm not, and I'm like somebody else said on there, shake hands and call them Your Honor and all this stuff. They don't have any honor. I'm just so disgusted with the weakness and the weak-minded Democrats that we got to think that the Republicans will ever change. And look at old Neil Bork. If he's ever a damn daggone idiot,
I know,
to get on there and say out clearly with three other people there on a panel, get the unions while you're at it. How plain can that be? I'm really.
Well, just once, Ed, I'd like to pin one of these labor haters down and find out why it is they hate them. I'd especially like to pin one of these working class folks down and say, what would be wrong with being a member of a union? It would increase your pay. You would have health care for your family. You'd have a meaningful retirement, and you might be able to retire before you died.
Yeah. And another thing, the very people that is against these benefit off of our taxes, such as the Congress and Senate that is against unions, and along with the preachers. They're all in the same boat. And the thing of it is, the preachers stand to gain more than any of them, because the higher the tithes, the higher the money they make, the higher the tithes they get. And they don't, it's just beyond me that kind of ignorance can prevail in any people that's paid by the taxpayer. But we got it. And these Southern, and Bobby's, I think, is about four or five of those Southern states that have car factories there, and the senators and so forth are stupid enough to try to bring the North down to the South. They have got over the ass kicking they got during the war.
See, you understand that, and I'm not gooning on our Northern listeners or anything, but I want them to understand that while they're saying, you know, we need to get over it, the folks that need to get over it ain't getting over it, and they're not going to get over it until they've got, I mean, people have got to understand that this North versus South, non-union versus union, Detroit versus Tuscaloosa and Vance and Spartanburg and so forth, it has its roots in 1860. And it
Well, that's the reason they're 100 years behind.
Yeah.
They're absolutely out of sync with modern times and what modern people need to have. But you know what? Well, you can look and see that you can go down there, and they do not understand what a right-to-work law state is, the difference between the North and South. They do not know what a closed shop or a union shop is, and there is nobody that I know of has ever run in the South that was willing to go along with that except Jimmy Carter. And that's another reason for the hatred toward him from these people like it's been those.
Well, Ed, let me ask you another question, though. Do Southern working folk even understand what right to work means? Do they understand what's being done to them?
Well, apparently they like it. But, you know, maybe, Bob, the only way to do is go over the legislators' heads that are from down there, and, pardon me, and get this bill through to where if the simple majority rules, then you got a union. Maybe they can overcome it. But you got a lot of workers that think that they can kiss hind end and get ahead by themselves without a union, and they don't realize that they're swimming among sharks. You know, they own the land, they own the factory, they own the tools, they own the money, they own the time clock.
Well, you know what? One of the things that's going to drive people, drive these right to workers really nuts is what recently happened in Tar Heel, North Carolina. Because
I don't know what that is.
Well, gosh, Tar Heel, North Carolina is the largest hog slaughtering facility in the world. They kill, slaughter, and chop up 32,000 hogs a day in Tar Heel, North Carolina for Smithfield Meats. It's maybe now I'll think about buying Smithfield again, but for the longest time I wouldn't buy anything made by Smithfield. Because of how, I mean, the company got sued, they got caught, they were intimidating workers, they lost a big part of their workforce were Latino, Hispanic workers. They've been run off out of the terror created by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people, the ICE men. And so what you have now is a lot of those jobs at Smithfield's Tar Heel kill factory were replaced by local African-American folk in North Carolina. And they recently voted to bring in the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, and they will have union representation in that plant. And see, that's, you know, it's another case of the sort of insanity of labor laws in this country. Smithfield has other plants in Ohio and so forth where the workers are already organized, and they're working along just fine. But they didn't want any union representation at that massive kill facility in Tar Heel, North Carolina. But now they're going to have it. And that's going to drive ignorant, white, redneck, stupid, working class folks in North Carolina absolutely out of their minds, because those people working in that union plant are going to have better lives. And it's going to drive the ignorant crackers absolutely out of their trees.
Well, Bob, even though we got the right to organize, and it's we got a right to a union shop, you got people in this state that still think the old time way, and you know we've run across them when we was organizing Norris Industries, the outfit that makes all the hubcaps for the auto industry. I had people drive up and read the literature that we were passing out, and one guy wadded it up and threw it back at me, and of course that wasn't too good for him. But that's the kind of attitude, you know. That's farm country. Number one, they don't understand unions, and they don't realize what a union can do to them. And it's like old Fred Holroyd and his bunch in here in Charleston. They used to come around, and I told you, they come in, what was the old stores? Hex.
Yeah.
They come in, my daughter worked at one of them and said, you know, they come in and told them, said, we won't let them take money out for union dues. Said, you don't have to pay these union dues. You know, just vote our way. And, I'm paraphrasing that a little bit, but that's basically what they told them. We'll protect you from the union. They're not going to get your money, not without a fight. I've had them, you know, they come in and turn out the lights and say, this is what a union shop is like. Or they'd pull the power switch, you know, where there wasn't nothing going, and hold out money on payday and then give it back to them on Monday and say, that's what your union dues would have been. They've got their tricks, and it's hard to tell what they're pulling.
Well, see, that's what goes on now. You know, we had a little bit of a fight in the legislature, in the West Virginia legislature just last year, Ed, where we tried to pass a bill that said that a worker had the right to get up and walk out of an anti-union meeting. And do you know the West Virginia legislature, the so-called pro-labor advocates of the West Virginia legislature, could not get that bill passed? Just to simply acknowledge the right of a working person to get up and walk out of a room when a bunch of garbage is being spewed by management.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, nothing about safety, nothing about well-being, nothing relating to the work, but just sitting there dogging a union.
Yeah. Well, if they don't do it that way, Bob, they come around, the supervisors, come around and get them one-on-one and tell them what's going to happen to another worker because he is supporting the union. And the way they do that, they'll fire one for being what they call overly active toward the union, and that scares the fire out of the rest of them, even though you're going to win that guy's job back because, you know, it was for participating in union activity. But in the meantime, when the election comes, half of them don't show up, and the ones that do vote against it. Or they will run in, like we had Fairchild in mining equipment. We tried to organize him, and they run in a couple other unions to, you know, because some of them were machinists, and they thought the machinists represented only machinists. And so they split it all to pieces, and we never did get a win out of them. But let me tell you something. If you think you're not full of dirty tricks, Santa Claus ain't got nothing on them.
Oh, yeah.
But these people, I listen to Corker and those guys like that, and how the Democrats can get in there and bargain with those kind of people is beyond me. They don't have to bargain with them. They're losers. But it don't seem like the Democrats understand that. And they don't seem like they understand what the public wants now. But until we get rid of that so-called Southern hospitality, the unions are not going anywhere down there because they don't know what it is, and nobody that I know of has ever run for shop union. The business would pound them under. They'd dump so much money after the guy that come up with that they might as well bury him. He'll never win. So I don't know the answer to it unless it is this, the workers wake up and say, okay, now let's see if we can get a union shop, and maybe the company make them mad enough, but about the time that happens, the company will give them a quarter raise on the hour and tell them they've got more in store for them if they go against the union.
Well, you make me wonder. I don't know the answer to this, Ed. I'd like to know what the nexus is between what happens, and dare I say when, not if, but when we pass the Employee Free Choice Act, what happens in the right-to-work states? In other words, what happens when a federal law butts heads up against a state right-to-work law? Or is there a nexus? I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen. Because of the people's ignorance and not understanding, the company is going to come out with so much hard, wrong, or bad propaganda against the union that because the worker has never been exposed, the only chance they got is migration of the northern worker to the south and spreading the word and telling them what the union had. And then the company's going to come back and say, yeah, you saw what the union done. They closed that shop down and moved it down here. It's just like the one that I told you about in Ypsilanti, Maryland, where the janitor was making $14 an hour, and they closed it down and moved it up next to Spencer here in West Virginia, up a holler, and the ambulance was running in now there more than the traffic was, where the guys was. They'd speed up those lines and stuff on them and fingers and, all the way half their arms and everything else because them old farm boys didn't know how to handle that stuff. So that's, Bob, they've got, like I said, not only do they own the land, the company, the tools and the money and the time clock, they own a process of propaganda. They've got the advantage over the union because those bosses are in there with those people, if the shifts are going 24 hours a day, and they can cause a split just like the Republicans are good for, that creates failure for the union. But I'm going to get off that, and I'm going to get off of here, but I just want to make a comment.
Go right ahead.
You've got two women that call in there. I think one of them, I'm not sure, I think one of them is Kay.
Kate.
And, of course, Juanita, she calls in regular. Don't forget that. But I listened to Kay the other night, and just a fantastic speaker. That's all I got to say. Fantastic knowledge, fantastic expression of that knowledge. And it's so good to listen to your show and hear people of that caliber call in there. Now, I don't know what state she's from. I hope it's from the South.
Well, now, Kate's kind of from all over, but mostly she's been lately of Arizona and then in the winters on the Mississippi Gulf Coast helping out with Katrina recovery.
Well, that's good that they're down there because they can spread good. You know, you got people think propaganda is all bad, but you got good propaganda and bad. And with the way she does it, it's got to spread, it's got to help. And as a hardcore union guy, I can appreciate her. She sounds like another Mother Jones to me. And I just appreciate it. And be sure to encourage them to speak out, because I, for one, could just sit. I don't have nothing to say when them kind of people talk. You just got a bunch of great call-in people that call in your show.
Well, it's the magnificent dynamic, Ed, that this idea has created, and it is made much more to the extent that it is made uplifting and unusual is made that way by folks not just Kate, not just Juanita, not just anybody who calls in. But you and the folks who periodically just pick up the phone and say, I can't stand it anymore, I gotta have my say. And the thing is that say can be had here, Ed.
Well, I don't have a lot of in-depth sayings like several of them do. But that is the problem. When I see so daggone much of it that I can't stand no more, then I guess that's the reason we've been getting a lot of call. I've been calling a lot is because of this auto thing. And I know most people are for that, but I despise those CEOs and those people that has created failure and going to get paid for it. And that there's a possibility that they'll use some of this money to buy stuff that is going to leave this country. Then, I guess my very soul rages over that. So I'll get off here and.
Well, you want me to put you back on hold and listen for a while?
Sure. Did Wayne call?
No, not well. I haven't heard from him in a couple of days.
Yeah, I haven't heard him in a while. I called him two or three nights ago, and he hadn't gotten home yet.
Well, we both know how busy Wayne stays.
Sure, I do. Sure do. I will. I am listening.
All right. Well, you stand by, Ed. I'll put you back on hold. All right.
All right. Thank you.
Uh huh. That's our buddy Ed, as you know, right here in Fayette County, with same county where I live. And conversation radio is a different beast from anything that's going on anywhere else. And I urge you to be part of it. If you have never picked up the phone and called, pick it up and call. Be a part of this process. Be a part of this family. The number, of course, on your own nickel, 304-658-3333. And you know me, I will do everything in my power to keep people from waiting on hold, except in the course of another conversation. I go to the phones when the phones ring, and try not to stack people up, although sometimes that's unavoidable in its own right. Toll-free, of course, if you need us to carry the cost of the call, which we're more than happy to do. It is 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head-on. And email rolls into bob@headonradio.com. Learn it, know it, use it. And speaking of email rolling in, a little bit of broadening of my knowledge of the Tennessee tax base, as we discussed with Luke. David writes in and says, with regard to the Tennessee tax base, some of the higher gas taxes are in the nation are in Tennessee. Our sales tax is, as Luke said, $7.25 on food. It is $8.25 on all other goods and services. Prescription drugs and medical treatment are exempted. In these times, this state is being Tennessee. This state is facing a likely $1 billion, yes with a B, billion dollar shortfall. Until consumerism and tourism come back, we're in a bind. And you know, we talked a little bit about that in terms of college financing and funding and university sports programs. It isn't going away. I got another report from our buddy, another David in South Carolina, talking about the crunch that is hitting South Carolina and their education system. And these aren't accidents. These, now when they hit, when these crunches hit, all the state government repig-licking conservative types want to act as if it's, you know, act of God. You know, it's some sort of economic tornado that just set down and nobody even saw a cloud in the sky. They made this stuff. They created this stuff. They made this misery. It is their baby, and they just don't want to bathe it. You know, it reminds me of... something that our dear friend, and I'm going right to the phones, our dear friend Eugene Finnerman published today. Eugene being, of course, the Internet's most brilliant satirist. A little something titled, Happy Birthday, Professor Santayana. Today is the birthday of George Santayana, whom you always meant to look up. Well, I'm saving you the trouble, Eugene says. George Santayana, 1863 to 1952, philosopher. He should be remembered for saying, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to misquote me. And you've certainly heard all the variations, like those who do not learn history, I'm guilty of that one, those who do not remember history, I've done that one too, and those who think I captured the Alamo and sang Black Magic Woman. Santayana actually said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. His appreciation of the past may be derived from the fact that he was born in Europe, where history is usually interesting. Had Santayana been born in New Madrid, Missouri, instead of the old one in Spain, he would never have warned us to remember the details of Benjamin Harrison. Indeed, he seemed to regard Americans as a nation of enthusiastic, affable dolts. We put the super in superficial. Writing in 1920 of America's emergence on the world stage, he explained our character to the European reader. And this is the quote. And let the, you know, back this on your iPod if you're listening later or whatever, your MP3 player, what have you. Back this up and listen to this a couple of times, because this is going to speak to you. This is going to get on you like a duck on a June bug. He said, American life is a powerful solvent. It seems to neutralize every intellectual element, however tough and alien it may be, and to fuse in the native goodwill, complacency, thoughtlessness, and optimism. One more time. American life is a powerful solvent. It seems to neutralize every intellectual element, however tough and alien it may be, and to fuse in the native goodwill, complacency, thoughtlessness, and optimism. Eugene says, of course, he waited until he was back in Europe before he published that. His impression of Americans as affable oafs is mystifying because he was not exactly mingling with the masses. Santayana spent 26 years teaching philosophy at Harvard, where his students included T.S. Eliot, Gertrude Stein, and Walter Lippmann. Maybe Gertrude could have been a linebacker for Radcliffe, but Tom and Wally would not have won any barroom brawls, and none of them was the least affable. In case you're wondering about the outcome of an Eliot and Lippmann brawl, I would bet on Wally. Lippmann knew how to defend himself. He'd cringe behind his tough friend John Reed, who would do the fighting. While we know Santayana for only that one quote, Bartlett's dedicates an entire page to him. Here is a sampling of the professor's wit and wisdom. These are good, too. Fanaticism consists in redoubling your efforts when you have forgotten your aim. The world is a perpetual caricature of itself. At every moment, it is the mockery and the contradiction of what it is pretending to be. Whew. Yeah, boy, that's a six-pack and a candle and some serious navel-gazing. And finally, this, perfect for a birthday, says Eugene, there is no cure for birth and death, save to enjoy the interval. And how true all of that is within the context of that which we are talking about. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Those Southerners who cannot remember that once upon a time their forebears had some union jobs, which they threw out, doom themselves to repeat a future that they do not want. But that's probably not sufficiently, sufficiently fused in native goodwill, complacency, thoughtlessness, and optimism. Is it now? And to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob Jovecchio.
Hey, Jovecchio. What's up, brother?
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Just sitting here through the snow. We've got a, I don't want to say significant, but we've got a decent little snowstorm going here in Chicago.
Well, this time of year, that's a good thing, isn't it?
It is a good thing. I like it. You know, actually, I like the first really big snowfall, and we've had snow here for a while, because it looks beautiful on the trees and the whites on the ground, and it's the wonderful sheen about it. But then after a couple of days, it all turns to slush, and we're all cursing it horribly.
Yeah, but when it first falls, and what's that Clement Moore line in the poem that's so popular this time of year, A Visit from St. Nicholas? And out on the breast of the new-fallen snow, yada, 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 yada.
Yep.
I never saw snow look like that, but I'll take Clement Moore's word for it. But there's a certain beauty to it, and there's a lightness and a and just a oh, I love it. And we've had a couple of good snows here, and for the first few minutes before it gets tracked up by my kids when they go out to play in it and so forth, it's stunning. It is stunning, even for people who are used to living with it. You can only imagine what it's like when it blows in on a place like New Orleans, like it did last week.
Right, and they're not used to it. It was funny in Atlanta. Whenever there was even a hint of snow, you could go to the store and not find any bread, milk, or eggs because people had rushed to the store to buy them all out. And I always joked that they would spend their time in their homes making French toast.
Well, you know that answers the question because I've always wondered what the eggs, bread, and milk made. I honest to God, I remember one of those things because I too share the Atlanta experience with you, Joe. I remember when WSB television had a guy out on an overpass over the downtown connector as it iced over, watching Southern drivers who had not a clue about being on the road in anything more than rain. It was mayhem, and they were cutting back. And now we go to our correspondent, team coverage, ice storm, 1988.
Well, I have experience with those ice storms in Atlanta. And actually, they're far worse than the snow because at least the snow on the ground you can see. The ice, you can't.
Are they coming for you there, Joe? I hear the siren in the background.
Yeah, that's typical. I live by Humboldt Park. Several of those every night. Just life here in Chicago. What was I going to say? Well, you know, driving, we have our dangerous driving problems here, too. I had to return the book to the library today, so I had to walk in the snow, and I almost got run over by a couple of blues musicians in a stolen police car. So it was a little bit dangerous there.
You know, I got, you know, in terms, it's funny you should mention that, and that's a great reference and good for a chuckle. I got to thinking about that scene, though. And that, wasn't that at the time the single largest car chase pileup scene in American cinematic history?
It might still be. It might still be.
And well, I wasn't sure. I thought maybe one of the Smokey and the Bandit movies had overtaken it or something. It passed it. I don't know.
I hadn't kept track. And actually, I like Smokey and the Bandit. That's my favorite CB movie of all time.
Well,
I don't know. I never actually counted.
Well, the reason I bring it up, Joe, is because I got to wondering, that scene, that marvelous, iconic chase scene in the Blues Brothers movie, what would that scene have been like had it all been shot with 1974 Civics?
I hadn't thought about that.
But, you know, the visceral force and effect of it would, oh my God, I'm turning into William Shatner. We come in peace. It wouldn't have been there.
And they really were. You know, the thing about it is I found that they really were driving underneath the loop there, on Wells Street, I believe, and for at least part of it. They were actually driving at about 120 miles an hour. Those were not speeded up frames. They were driving that fast in that, and filming that sequence.
good work if you can get it. If you're, you know, I guess the entire Joey Chitwood Thrill Show, you know, was nicely employed for a month, a couple of days there.
Well, you know, I took my new roommate here in Casa Vecchio, Eric, nice guy from Los Angeles, so he's not used to any kind of cold weather. But I took him downtown primarily to see Chris Kindlemart, which is this big German festival thing they have in Daly Plaza, where they have all these German shops selling, you know, wonderful beer steins and trinkets, and they got a couple of beer barns and wonderful chocolate and bratwurst that you would die for.
Okay, this is the food porn segment of the program now. We have segued.
We have segued. But I showed him some of the areas where they filmed the Blues Brothers. In fact, a little the spot where the car stopped and fell apart as they got out, and they showed the scene of those two little statue guys looking at them.
Yeah.
Briefly, that building is right across from Daly Plaza. And, of course, Daly Plaza itself, which the car tore through. And actually, I had told was indirectly responsible for Mayor Byrne losing her position, because they filmed that. They crashed through Daly Plaza and split town without paying for any of it. And Chicago had to foot the bill for that. But I was listening to what you were saying earlier, and it is, you know, it's sad to see. And I get so frustrated in this country trying to talk to people and try to talk rationally and reasonably to people, and there just doesn't seem to be a whole heck of a lot of that. People sometimes are so ruled by their emotions that they're not capable of anything. And I was looking over, the perfect example is this shoe-throwing incident, which is a riot. I picked up a GIF. Someone made an animated GIF. They took Curly throwing a shoe, Bush ducking, and then they had this shot from Larry getting hit with the pie in the face. It was absolutely perfectly done. And, you know, how some people, especially, you know, Bush himself and a few of our American journalists are angry at this guy for throwing a shoe, saying, you know, how dare he do that? He should be grateful for everything that we've done for their country. And I had my analogy. It was like, you know, people saying that Iraqis should be grateful for everything we've done for them is kind of like a rapist telling his now pregnant victim that she should thank him for allowing her to experience the joy of motherhood.
Amen.
I mean, that's the best analogy. I mean, we go in there, you know, how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people did we kill outright? How many millions did we drive out? They get electricity for, what, 2 or 3 hours of the day? Their water is filth because we blew up all their recycling plants, not recycling.
Well,
you know,
yeah, their water treatment plants, their infrastructure, the critical civilian infrastructure that under the UN and the so-called law of war, that doing that sort of thing is considered a what's the word I'm looking for here, Joe? The phrase? The war crime.
Crime, exactly. And, you know, Bob, you and I, and pretty much all the people listening in, we were brought up, we were raised by our teachers, whether we went to public or private school, we were brought up, we were raised, we believe, and taught that Americans were moral people, noble people, who would not, you know, never in a million years do something like this, and that the law applies to everybody. That's what we were taught. And as I grew older, I realized how untrue it is, and here we're seeing a perfect example of how people who perpetrated this will never seemingly, and I hope I'm wrong on this, but will seemingly never have any accountability for anything they've done in office. That you can, that if you're of a certain class of people in this country, there is a different set of laws for you than there are for guys like you and me. You know, if I messed up things that bad, you know, I'd be going to jail. If I went,
well,
if
that,
I went
that's
into
the, that's the
convenience store with or without a gun, and not even threatened to do anything, just made loud yelling noises and, you know, cavorted around, they'd haul my ass off to jail. They'd haul me off to jail, Bob, and there wouldn't be a damn thing I could do about it.
You know, somebody sent me one of those funny little things you get in your email every now and then. It concerned, it was, you know, I think the title of it was Why My Husband Is No Longer Allowed to Enter Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cute. And the last one was that the guy was finally asked never to darken Walmart's doorway again after going into the ladies' dressing room and several minutes later hollering, "Hey, there ain't no toilet paper in here."
Oh, that's rich.
But,
I like that.
You know, the fact of the matter is they'd send the riot squad for that.
Oh, sure. They'd tase you to death.
So it's, it's not just me. I mean, you get that. The idea that, the second set of rules, well, it's what George Carlin said some years back. There is a club, and you ain't in it, and they don't want you in it.
Right. And someone brought up a quote by one of the Medicis, something that I wasn't aware of, and they were saying the purpose of money is to get power, and the purpose of power is to protect money. And that's, I think that's exactly what we're seeing here, money using power to protect itself.
Well, because I once formulated a theory way, way back in the bad old days of my cup of coffee in law school. I formulated a theory that the American law exists for the purpose of the three M's: money, meanness, and morons. In other words, we're going to protect the money from the meanness of the morons and punish the morons for hurting the money. Because it really does boil down to that for the most part. And frankly, I think I'm being vindicated in that estimation, insofar as I have waited and waited and waited for somebody to do something about Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, George Bush. Yeah, and we know. We know now. These people, on the way out of office, these people are admitting, Joe, they're admitting their crimes, and they're doing that to us.
Pretty much. They've been doing that to us, since they got in. Because that's all they know how to do, man. That's all they know how to do. Grab money, grab power, and lord it over the rest of us. And it's sickening that it looks like they're walking away from it. Now, I talked with my good friend, Athena Fascistan, about this, and he's doing very well, and he says hello, by the way.
Oh, hey to the thing.
And we were discussing this, and we were saying what we ought to do is we ought to organize a really big lecture series promising millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, for them to give lectures abroad. And the second they cross the border, have some international police group mail them. Actually, what you can do is you can also promise them on the side lots of sex with little boys, because that'll drag in Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and a few other those too. And then as soon as they're across the border, just throw the cuffs on and toss them in prison and work out the specific charges later. Put them up against put them up in a tribunal in a war crimes trial, because that's really what they do. And it's frustrating to me to sit there and think that they're never going to get punished for it. They're never going to get punished for it. And here I sit in my little one-room place, barely making by on food stamps, just trying to, pass this stupid computer course so I can get a job and not go 2 or 3 days a month without eating, because that's basically all unemployment and food stamps will cover. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I wish they would be forced to live like this for the rest of their lives for what they've done. But they're never going to. The difference between how they're treating the bailout of the auto industry and the bailout of Wall Street, where nobody has, nobody just, talks about sending any of the Wall Street people to prison or making them go bankrupt. Yet, of course, mostly Southern, and you and I have gone back and forth on this before, Bob. It's mostly Southern Republicans who want desperately to destroy the union because they hate working people. They absolutely hate the idea.
And that's the only thing you can come down to with those people. I've named them repeatedly this evening: Corker, Shelby, Sessions, Alexander, Demented, McConnell, Coburn. Yeah, those are the trouble.
And they're not even trying to hide it.
And Southern Democrats, remember, Blanche Lincoln, Democrat from Arkansas, was right there elbow to elbow with those thugs. And you can't sit there, you cannot make, I'm not saying you, this is the sort of broad generalization. You cannot make a cogent argument that anything that those good-for-nothing self-made sons of bitches are doing has any grounding in any sort of economic philosophy apart from we hate unions, we want the unions dead, 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 because the unions got some money we'd like to have.
Right. There's no amount of money in the world that they can't have that they don't want. I don't know if I said that wrongly, but you know what I'm saying. There's no amount of money in the world that they don't want to get their grubby little hands on. They would love to get their hands on all that Social Security money. And then you piss it away gambling, which is what they did on Wall Street, basically.
Yeah, and that's why you're a movie buff. I'm a movie buff. That's why somewhere, in some sort of realm of, oh, I don't know, divine justice. I want to see Mitch McConnell and Richard Shelby and Jeff Sessions and Jim DeMint and Lamar Alexander and Bob Corker and Tom Coburn and Blanche Lincoln and that whole filthy crowd. I want to see them reenact that ending scene, or perhaps penultimate scene, from Marathon Man. You remember the one where Laurence Olivier at gunpoint had to eat the diamonds.
Yeah, I remember that. God, it's been years since I've seen that.
I want to see these soulless bastards who know nothing, Joe, nothing about working for a living. I want to see them eat gobs of money. I want to see them swallow silver dollars whole. And
yeah,
see if that finally satisfies their damnable greed.
You're actually being much kinder than I would be at that point. So let me just go on record as saying that right there. Quite frankly, what I really want, I can't say on the air because they would send a riot squad out here.
Yeah, the humorless guys with the skinny black ties, right.
Yeah, exactly. They would send. Well, yeah, and they wouldn't be on a mission with God, from God, you know.
You'd be surprised how often we use that around here. Yeah, with my best imitation, phony Chicago, we're on a mission from God.
But, you know, the thing is, through all of it, I still try as best I can to maintain my sense of humor about it. Because if I didn't, I'd go insane. If I didn't laugh so much, I'd be crying. You know what I mean?
That's all we got left.
That's all we got left. And, you know, and there comes a point where you simply say there's certain things they just can't take away from you.
And maybe here's another obscure reference. Maybe that's something from that's that thing from The Name of the Rose. If we maybe screaming at them isn't the thing anymore. Maybe pointing at them and throwing rotten vegetables and laughing at them. Because among other things, you know, one of the reasons that you hate working people is you hate for working people to have leisure time to enjoy their existences. You want them huddled over a crust of bread and begging and praying to an unknowing, unseeing, unfeeling, unliving God that they'll just make it till tomorrow. Maybe laughing at these bastards is one of the remedies. You old fool.
Well, I want to do that, but I want to do that from a point of view where we actually can, you know, support ourselves and make a living. And I don't understand why that's such a difficult proposition for some people, where you get a job and you make enough money to support yourself properly and enjoy your life, instead of just, you know, are you there a piece of meat that's worth X amount of money to X amount of people, or are you just a human being who wants to do whatever you want to do with your life? Maybe be somewhat ambitious, maybe be not ambitious at all, maybe just be happy being a friggin' janitor, okay? But you're happy in that, and just enjoy your life. And I don't understand.
Yeah,
why.
Well, you know, when Mitch McConnell's toilet backs up and he's got an Old Faithful of caca blowing toward the ceiling in his bathroom, you know, I'm thinking all of a sudden that's probably a moment when he's got a hell of a lot of reverence for a working American.
Well, maybe not. He probably gets him in there and, you know, screams at the guy for not getting it done in 2 seconds.
Well, or hires an undocumented immigrant at a lower rate.
Bob, I've discussed this before, and I've talked to you about this on your show before. Conservatism boils down to one simple single statement.
Cheap labor.
Some people are better than others. Some people are better than others. That's it.
Yeah, and that, of course, is downright Calvinist.
But that's what they believe. I mean, whether you're talking about Egyptian pharaohs or Roman emperors or French monarchs or British monarchs, the nobility, the idea, whether you call them the elite, nobility, the motor of the world, whatever you call them, the premise is that there are some people who actually do all the creating. They're the ones that make the world, and everybody else should shut the heck up and take what you're given by them because, you know, they're the ones that do everything. In order, you know, these people honestly believe that the executives, the money people, are the ones that create everything. You know, the greed is good crowd, to make another movie reference.
Yeah, the Gordon Geckos of the world.
Yeah, and who, you know, who believe that, you know, working people don't actually create anything. They just do what others tell them to do. And
yeah,
that's not true. And what they're most afraid of, and some of them are aware of this and some of them aren't, because some of them live in such a bubble they really aren't aware of it. But what some of them are most afraid of is that working people will realize how much power they have if they stick together, because they don't make a penny without us. And Lincoln understood that. Lincoln said in one of his addresses, he said that labor is first. Labor comes before capital because you can't have capital before labor. So therefore, labor should be given the greater emphasis. And Teddy Roosevelt brought that up in his New Nationalism speech, which was one of my favorite speeches.
Well, you know, Frank and Angel in our chat room is pointing out, she says, it's not only the people at the top, it's also the brainwashed people at the bottom that think that God will take care of everything and will not do anything to help to make this country and world better themselves. It's like a scary movie.
It is like a scary movie. And also there are those...
Well, yeah, we're looking at American workers now. And what's that janitor making $65,000 a year for? It's like looking at the bimbo in a horror movie going, don't go into the basement! Don't go into the basement! But American workers are going into the basement because they think that... They don't think that they're not making enough. They think that that guy's making too much.
Yeah, and I pointed this out years ago. I wrote a column called Misery Loves Company. These are miserable, miserable people who hate themselves and hate their lives, and the only pleasure they get is knocking other people down. You know, and you're absolutely right. It's not that, well, how come we can't make $60 an hour? It's like, how come he isn't making $5 an hour like I am?
Yeah.
You know? And they want to drag everybody
I mean,
down.
Don't these idiots realize that if they were making the $65 an hour, they could give more to their church?
Don't get me started.
I know. I just put a lit match to a short fuse. I understand.
They won't even accept it in Christian terms, if you put it that way. What was that governor of Alabama who?
Bob Riley,
who tried to use in Christians that Jesus would want us to help the poor, and he almost got kicked out of office.
Well, he's a Republican. He is a Southern Baptist, and it was he who tried to reduce the effective state income tax rate on the poorest Alabamians, because I think I mentioned it in just the last few shows. The tax code in Alabama at the time that Riley was talking about this imposed income taxes on anybody working in the state of Alabama who made more than $9,000 per year. And Bob Riley said, you know, my church teaching teaches me that this is sinful. And you know, I have to thank that whole transaction, because one of my favorite catchphrases on this show came out of that, because corporate Alabama put out press releases that said, for saying such a thing, that Bob Riley was, and I quote, crazier than a sprayed roach. That's right.
Alabamans voted against their own interests.
They didn't walk. They didn't crawl. Poor, dirt poor, straggling, scrambling, the hard scrabble working Alabamians ran to the polls to vote with their corporate Alabama masters and against the principles of their zombie god that they claim to love.
Now, Bob, and I want to bring this up because we talked about this just it was election night, okay, and we got into a little argument about, you know, Southerners and stuff like that, and you talked about the proud history of West Virginians, okay, and about how, and I agree with you how, you know, if it wasn't for all the hard work that West Virginians do, cities like Chicago wouldn't have enough coal to heat us in the winter, okay? And it's very true. I agree with you. But who did West Virginia turn around and vote for in this last election?
Look, more Alabama votes were cast for John McCain than were cast for George Bush.
Sure. So, and there's really, it gets to a point where you just say, you know, there's really not much we can do to help you people, you know? And the only thing we can do, and that's slowly happening, and you're seeing it now, that we have to isolate these pockets of the country.
That is why, in talking with Ed a few minutes ago, I said it's a little bit like MacArthur. You don't want to do a landing on Truck Island. You isolate Truck Island and starve it out and go around it.
That's right. And I think with the 50-state strategy, I think that's very good. And, you know, I was talking again with my friend Zane, and we were discussing, because he had Obama pegged to win it months ago. He had him pegged to beat Hillary in the primaries. He knew that Obama was going to be president. He just knew it because he had worked with him, and he knew that Obama was a hard-as-nails politician. Okay? A big city guy. Not you know, look, I love Clinton and I love Carter, but let's face it, they were small-town dudes. Okay? And they played small-town politics. Obama doesn't play small-town politics. He plays big city politics. And he's not going to fall into the same trap that Bill Clinton fell into, because he's going to bring people who know how to get stuff done. Okay? Whether they're ideologically pure or not, you know, people will bitch about, but the important thing is people who know what the hell they're doing, right? And he pointed out to me, and I've completely lost my train of thought here, but he pointed out to me how Obama simply wasn't going to play the same game with these people. And that's what we're facing now.
Well, I think what, you know, I can't overestimate, Joe, the value of the Employee Free Choice Act. Because, you know, some of these things have to, and once again, these things have to be done for the South, not to the South. And one of those things is making people able to band together and stand together and have a collective bargaining unit with their employer.
Mm-hmm.
And once that happens, and once people are able to go to the doctor when they're sick, once they have gotten past all the rhetoric of you'll be a commie or you'll be a Bolshevik or God won't love you anymore, and they see that their lives are materially, exponentially improved, then all these right to workers and all these dividers and all of these family values conservatives will become like unto the dinosaurs of old. And they will, they'll wander into a tar pit one day and just not wander out again.
And they'll be marginalized. And, I'm hopeful that happens. Because listen, you know, I want everybody to do well, Bob. You know, even the most ignorant redneck Southerners, the ones that I spew my most venom at for just being idiots and just voting for people who are constantly hurting them. I want them to do well. You know, the Republicans, they want them to be poor and miserable morons. I want them to be happy and prosperous morons. Okay, I can't do anything.
And maybe even cure some of the moronic.
Well, you know, I can't. I don't know if I can do anything about that. I don't. You know, I think stupidity is its own problem. But we can at least do the best we can to make sure that it's a healthy, happy stupidity instead of a miserable, dangerous, gun wielding stupidity.
Yeah.
And I think American Union's biggest failure in the 40 or 50 years, you know, of its existence, or 70 actually, but is that they never really tried to apply that to workers all around the world, because working people realistically know no country. There is no country for them in that sense. They are basically just trying to scrabble and fight and scratch for a living, and they're going to go where they think the best.
Well, and see, I mean, that's the cycle that as it existed, Joe, is that, for instance, you had union, first of all, you had people working in sweatshops in New England and the American Northeast who were treated like dirt. I mean, do we really need to go over the history of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire?
Right. That's how modern liberalism came into being, part of it. Right.
Right. And so when the unions came in there, because America was not did not have a uniform labor law, well, those textile mills eventually packed up and went south.
South, right.
And eventually some of those were unionized. Okay? That whole look for the union label thing, the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, was vibrant once upon a time. I don't know if they even exist anymore. But they were in mills in the South, and because of the psychopathology of the South, the company owner said, well, you know, we're gonna have to move the plant, because you know these communist Bolshevik union agitators are in here now, and you know, we'd hate to put your, and you know what, they didn't move for a while. The NFL possesses in the form of Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. Those two had operative procedures to repair typical football-related injuries in the offseason. And now, Peyton Manning was laid up, I think, weeks on end, not because of any recovery process coming back from the surgery, but because he picked up an ugly dose of MRSA, medication-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. And it laid him low, and it's part of why the Colts haven't done as well as the Colts were expected to do this year. Same thing with Tom Brady. Now, these people have access to multi-million-dollar gold-plated health care. And they're getting laid low by a bug that we can't kill because we've, frankly, abused antibiotic technology in this country. Tim, Russert. The guy dropped dead from preventable heart disease at work. And he had, again, multi-million dollar gold-plated health coverage. You know, for me, what this does, Joe, is it points out the broad spectrum of problems that we only have. We only have 4 years and at best 8 years to fix. Because by the end of 4 or 8 years, the Republicans will be back and they're counting on Barack Obama to fix the economy so that they can steal it again. And something has to happen between now and 2012 or 2016. So things must happen that make it impossible for a son of a Bush or any other sort to ever get their hands, or any Republican to ever get their hands on the reins of power in this country again.
Well, the thing has reason to believe, well, he believes that the Republicans are going to be in the wilderness for another 70 years or so. The reason they were in the wilderness for so long to begin with was because of the New Deal, people were much more politically active during that time, and the Republicans weren't able to get away with so much. Now, of course, they were still strong in the South, I guess, although the South was an integral part of the New Deal, but it was conservative Southerners who still had racism on their minds. But, you know, I really don't think the country, quite frankly, is that well-educated. And I think that if Obama manages to fix everything too quickly, if that's at all possible, considering the amount of work he's got ahead of him, then people would just go back to relaxing and thinking everything is okay and go right back to their ideology again. Because back in the 70s and 80s, while things weren't great, you know, Reagan preached, you know, it's these guys that are the fault of things are going bad and everything's going good for you for the most part. So, you know, I'm a nice-looking guy. You can trust me. I look like your old grandfather. Let me handle things. And what's the result of 30 years of Reaganomics is the completely and total collapse, almost the complete and total collapse of our economy. And the death of the middle class of this country and so many things that need to be taken care of that it's mind-boggling that anybody could even consider wanting to tackle them.
Well, this is – okay, here's a question then for you, Joe. Is this – oh, thank God we don't have more right-wingers listening than we do. Is this the point where you look up and you say, you know, maybe Khrushchev was right? You know, the whole we will conquer you without firing a shot?
No, he wasn't right because the communists didn't really have any answers to begin with.
No, but what I'm getting at is the idea that he put forward that we would destroy ourselves.
That part I agree with. I mean, you could see it coming. I mean, how many times do we talk about, who's my favorite ancient Greek writer?
Thucydides.
Thucydides. And how many times, you know, do we have to relive this? You know, and it happens to every country. It happened to the Athenians. It happened to the Romans. As soon as one nation gets a hold of that much power and money, it attracts the worst kind of people. It always does. And unless you have a system that's very strong, eventually you succumb to it because ambitious people, let's face it, they're very freaking good at what they do. They are very good at what they do. Caesar was extremely good at what he did, and so were his immediate predecessors. Augustus certainly was very good at what he did. And that's what you have to take into consideration. You have to be constantly on guard for these people. And it's a never-ending struggle because it's a pathology. That there's a mental instability there that says, I have X, but I'm not satisfied until I get twice X. And even when you got twice X, you say, well, I want twice more. It's like a big black hole you have to keep tossing money into. And it never ends. It never ends.
And it consumes itself. That's the ultimate end of unrestrained capitalism, is that it destroys itself.
It destroys itself. And never mind the welfare queens, Bob. These are the real parasites. Because we could solve all of the problems we have in this country, economically speaking, if we started taxing the very, very wealthy and the big corporations the way they should be taxed. You know, these southern senators who give Honda and Toyota all these millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks, billions of dollars in tax breaks to build plants there to provide jobs. And, of course, the working people there are just happy to have a damn job, okay? But, meanwhile, they're being sold out. And the union, the UAW winds up getting crushed. And what's going to happen to those people once they crush the union? You think they're going to have any kind of recourse? Some people are better than others, Bob. That's the way they see it.
And
we're better than you, and you take what we give you.
And life is nasty, brutish, and short.
Nasty, brutish, and short. And you're lucky to get the scraps that we give you. Trickle down. And you all know, when I first heard that, the only thing I could think of, there's only one thing that rolls downhill, Bob.
Yep, there is.
It rolls downhill.
And it ain't no fun. No matter who it lands on, it ain't nice because it stinks up the place for everybody else.
And it's just an assumption that, you know, this group of elite people, and it's probably around maybe 30 or 40,000 people in this country that control the bulk of the wealth. And those are the parasites, not the couple of welfare queens who drive to the supermarket in a Cadillac and get, you know, $400 worth of T-bone steaks, which doesn't really exist, you know. But, of course, it's easy to point a blame because you can see them lazy, shiftless black people hanging around, them brothers there. They're not worth anything, and they're getting your tax money. Don't you understand? They're getting your tax money. And meanwhile, you got this rich white guy who's sucking up, you know, the type of money that a million welfare queens couldn't suck up. Well, he's a good entrepreneurial man. He's a businessman.
He's American.
He's American. He's downright, he's the epitome of what we should be, and you should also try to be him. And they leave us no recourse. You know, it's kind of like you're sitting next to a kid in class, okay? And the kid is poking you every 30 seconds, just poking you with his finger. And you try to tell him to stop, you try to get him to stop, and he doesn't stop, and finally you're forced to bust him in the face just to get him to stop. And you don't want to bust him in the face. You're a nice person. You want to try to be reasonable, but they don't give you any choice. They don't give you any choice at all. You have to become like them. And that's what angers me even the most, because they're making me think the most vile, nasty thoughts about what I want to do to them, what I want to do to them, what I want to see happen to them because of what they do. And I am not like that. I am a kind, nice person. Anybody who knows me that, well, I have my faults. I am a nice person, and I don't want to see harm to anybody, but they make me think like they do, and that's what pisses me off more than anything else. That's what pisses me off. Because I am not like them. I don't want to be like them. I just want them to stop messing with my life. And they can't help but mess with my life because that's all they know how to do.
And, that's also a sign of the lack of depth that those lives have. Joe, this has been a wonderful conversation, brother. Good to hear from you.
It is really good to be on your show again, Bob. And I'm sorry I don't call as often as I do, but I'm trying to make something out of my own life.
I understand that, but anytime the spirit moves you, we're here.
And listen, if I could just pull a plug for my blog once more.
Absolutely.
cupojoe.blogspot.com, cupofjoe.blogspot.com. I go in and out with posts, but I have some really good posts when I get cracking in there. And if you want to drop a dime in the bucket, it's getting on Christmas, Joe. Could always use a little bit of help, but that goes beyond saying that.
Yep, here. We'll talk to you later, Joe, and if I don't talk to you before the holidays, Merry Christmas to you. Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas to you, too, and say hi to everybody over at the shack out there.
I sure will. Take care, Joe.
Bye-bye, Bob.
Bye now. That's Horn alum Joe Vecchio. And, you know, one of these days, maybe we get Joe back. I'd love for that to happen. And, well, Joe's just a straight-up, straight-shooting kind of guy. And I love what he has to offer. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Preston.
Hey, I'm going to have to visit Joe's blog. I really enjoyed what he was talking about just now. That's Cup.
Cupojoe, C-U-P-O-J-O-E .blogspot.com.
Okay, great. I've been finding lots of great blogs.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people out there with a lot of great ideas. The initial motivating idea behind bloggery is a beautiful one. Because it's that whole let a thousand flowers bloom kind of thing. And there are a lot of brilliant people with a lot of great ideas. The question becomes one of getting them out there.
Yep, that's so true. You know, they're very much in the tradition of Tom Paine and the other pamphleteers.
Yeah.
Hopefully people can find the linkages and the networks that they need to sustain themselves. I found another good one called, My Single Mom Life, and it's a lady raising a couple teenage kids by herself, and just a lot of the day-to-day struggles that are also overlooked in so much of our media, which is constantly diverting us to these you know, sending us off on wild goose chases at best, if not trying to pervert our nature in the ways that Joe was talking about, you know, trying to make us brutal and selfish and vicious and unkind.
And forcing us into choice, into Hobson's style choices.
Yep. Yep.
You know, the horse at the door or no horse at all. You know, the non-union job or no job at all. The sweatshop job or starvation. Those aren't choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Get a car, travel by car, or don't have a job, you know. I mean, we're wrapped into the auto industrial complex, you know, in so many ways. And you know, it's nuanced. I mean, in some ways, cars can be great and very convenient and helpful, enjoyable. But the ways in which it's a market that's imposed on us, you know.
Look at the degree to which either a deep-voiced country music star or a scantily clad woman is used to market them. I frankly don't understand, for instance, Volkswagen's latest advertising campaign where they have Brooke Shields saying, don't have a baby just so you can get a Volkswagen minivan. Huh?
Right, right.
And the fact of the matter is, you know, if the thing can't, if you're selling it based upon cinematography, you're not selling that automobile. You're selling a cinematographer.
Right. You know, and there are so many other side products that we're being sold on. You know, they focus our attention on taxes. They don't want us to think about these kind of imposed and flexible consumer expenditures because they get the money from those dollars out of our pockets, not the government.
Well, you know, I know exactly what you're talking about. Go ahead.
One quick example of these side expenses, taxes from being consumers when we get a car, is that we have to take out loans. And there's that whole racket of how much we get charged each month to make the car payments. And then there's the insurance industry who's going to get their cut of the action. You know, maybe that's something else we need to consider, universal insurance, you know, and then there's the brake costs and the spark plugs and the on and on and on. And so many options. We look at our own history of trolley cars. They were wonderful, sociable, enjoyable in many ways. I just saw a documentary on the Sundance Channel last week called Contested Streets. And Copenhagen, Denmark, was one of the cities they featured, and they talked about how they had many of the same sorts of problems that we've got with congestion and people getting run over by cars and animals getting killed all the time. They decided to change it. They, you know, first they believed they could change it. You know, they had the visions.
Mm-hmm.
They believed in themselves, and they did it. And they had these politicians and people saying, you know, each day in Copenhagen, we know we don't do a lot of things right, but we know each day it's a little better. What a radical concept, instead of just accepting that we should be sinking down into this ecocidal war dystopia.
Yeah, well, it's not just, you know, it's not just ecocidal, it's homicidal.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's suicidal, even. And, you know, so much of the, you know, I mentioned that beautiful post from our buddy Eugene Finnerman about this being George Santayana's birthday. And I've already forgotten the actual proper quote because everybody misquotes it. But everything flows out of that. It's what we don't bother to learn that winds up biting us in the butt. It's what we don't bother to think about that winds up being the plague on our doorstep. You know, and toward that end, I try to think. Oh God, I hate that phrase too. Out of the box. But for instance, you know, we talk about, because you mentioned cars. We talk about the fact that, well, you know, we need hybrids, we need plug-in electrics.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to be the cynic at anybody's birthday party or anything, but is there anyone out there that thinks that because, you know, all of this is predicated upon the notion of, well, we ain't gonna have to buy no more gas. Is there anyone out there who thinks that the electric power companies are going to sit idly by while we shift our economic transportation infrastructure over to electric and not go and absolutely beat down the doors of various and sundry public service commissions to make sure that the money that was going into oil now goes into electricity?
Yeah.
You know, is it Tom Hartman that's noted that the cost of a suit is roughly the same in 1840 as it is in 1940 as it is in 2008, that only the valuation of the money has been changed? Isn't that one of those things that Tom, that sounds like Tom?
Yeah. I'd actually on the issue of, you know, hybrids and all that, I mean, there are plenty of problems with those and the whole electric cars and, you know, the batteries. They're very energy, I mean, intensive, and they use a lot of energy to make these batteries and all the steel and digging up the, you know, and on and on and on. So I think, you know, that's a step, though, to mitigating some problems. I think there are larger, you know, more radical visions that we need to start to entertain, again, to allow ourselves to entertain something like, oh, I don't know, maybe some of those car factories creating light rail.
Rail cars, bingo, yeah.
Making cities we can walk in again. And again, that was the
and make it, and frankly, you know, because I admit my bias, making rural America walkable.
Yeah,
I'm very serious about that because I do think of these because I'm not an urban person or a suburban person, I'm a rural person. I think of things in rural terms, and nobody in their right mind would walk out to the U.S. highway that's a quarter of a mile from where this studio sits. Nobody in their right mind would walk out there and walk to the grocery store. It's 6 miles away, uphill, and then 6 miles back. But in those 6 miles, you're going to be passed by untarped, negligent, careless, speeding coal trucks. A pebble from any one of which could do to you what that pebble did to the forehead of Goliath, the Philistine giant.
Yep. Transportation could be framed very easily as a security issue. I mean, people trying to make their way across these, you know, two-lane each-way roads, elderly people that maybe shouldn't be driving but kind of have to, and their eyesight's not so good. And, you know, 40,000 people a year killed on our highways and a couple hundred thousand grievously injured.
Exactly. My grandmother, bless her heart, was run over by a speeding driver at the age of 60, broke both her knees. And they told her she'd never walk again, but you know, that's the wrong thing to tell her. She was mean. Doggedly, determinedly, came back to, had to walk with a cane and walked slowly the rest of her life. But by God, she walked, she raised a garden, all of that, on sheer grit and determination.
Wow.
There comes a time when I think, I don't know quite how to say this, Preston, but there comes a time when we ought not be demanding grit and determination of some Americans, that they have given all the grit they've got to give, that they have shown all the determination we should ask of a single human being, and that they deserve an end that is something better than being warehoused with a feeding tube directly pouring into their stomach.
Yep. Yep. Grit and determination have their place, but so do joy and harmony and, you know, ease of living, really. It doesn't need to be such a drudgery. I love Joe's phrase about trying to help people become, you know, more happy and prosperous morons.
happy
poor ones.
Right, happy morons. If you want to do the rest of the moron stuff, fine, but I want you to be a happy moron, and I'm with him on that.
Yeah, and I count myself among those morons at times, for sure. You know, a lot of the thought traps I've fallen for, and I'm sure I'll continue to discover more along my way. So I think, you know, as we try to speak to people at the dinner table or people at our jobs who seem so disinterested, are so overcome by their emotions, if we try to bring up, you know, radical ideas, I don't know, trying to keep in mind that, you know, we were in their shoes as well, and in some ways we're still in their shoes. you know, Joe was talking about, you know, how do we approach people like that? And, you know, if he talks about what he was talking about with you, I think they'd be open to it. I mean, what he was saying about what, you know, Teddy Roosevelt said and the other president that he cited, help people to remember our own history and that we can say things about the princes of industry and not be Karl Marx. You know, that was FDR.
Yeah.
And point out that that's why Limbaugh goes after him. And point out that conservative radio isn't. Conservative radio is a collection of PR agents from firms like Hill & Knowlton, the Rendon Group, Ketchum. Point that out to people. I think they'll, you know, they might even get angry at you or emotional, but still, when they tune into Hannity, they're going to remember that. You know, try not to think of a PR agent. Tell them that.
Yeah, don't think of an elephant.
Exactly. Hill & Knowlton's on my mind recently. They were involved with the first attack on Iraq, and, you know, they helped push the babies being thrown out of incubator stores.
Right. Okay. Yep.
The Rendon Group is the one that's been doing a lot of work on the second Iraq attack on those people. Involving a lot more than shoes, for sure.
And you know, speaking of the PR war, and it really is, it's public relations militarized.
Yeah.
One of the things that I haven't seen, maybe you have, maybe someone else has, but one of the things I haven't seen, Preston, is footage in the wake of George Bush's shoe-in in Baghdad. One of the things I haven't seen is the footage of all the Iraqis. Once we had covered Saddam Hussein's face on the statue with an American flag and used heavy equipment to pull that statue down, you know, you couldn't turn on a cable news channel back in the day without seeing footage of Iraqis beating that statue with their shoes.
Yeah.
Well, suddenly that image has disappeared now, hasn't it?
Yep. They also disappeared a lot of the guy's words as he was throwing the shoes. Some of them were kept saying, oh, he called Bush a dog. You know, what a fool, what a crazy man this is. They took out the part about it. You know, this is for all the
widows and the orphans.
Yep. But it's getting around. You know, again, the beauty of the bloggers, the modern-day pamphleteers, you know, they're helping out, getting the truth out about that, and, you know, so many of the other progressive media developments, which I'm sure 10 years ago people thought would have been impossible, you know, but here we have it. And I don't mean to, you know, disrupt people's joyrides in their cars. I don't want to have a wholly negative analysis of cars and the car culture. Again, I think it can happen.
Yeah, because even I'm going to have a problem with that, Preston, because I get real worked up about them. It's in my, yeah.
My
but, and, you know, that's one of the things I was, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to just jump on you. Okay. One of the things that I was reflecting on, we've got a lot of, not a lot, but we've got some old Ford memorabilia around here because my grandfather Kincaid, sold cars for the local Ford dealership, and he was a master of, and he raised it to an art. I remember one story about a very frustrating experience he had because a woman came in and wanted to order a car. You know, that's Detroit. You know, that really is. You could factory order a car. They would build the car that you wanted and ship it to you. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You could factory order, and so she wanted to factory, nothing suited her on the lot, so she was going to factory order a car. And she ordered a two-door Mercury. And it took about 6 weeks. It came in, and it was a beautiful thing. And she came and said, this is not the car I ordered. And my grandfather said, well, yes, it is. And he ticked off the list. It's got this, and the dual mud flaps, and the overhead, blah, 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 blah. And she said, but it's not a two-door. And he said, what do you mean? It is a two-door. There's the door, and on the other side is the other. No, two doors on each side. And I think that's about when my grandfather went across the street to the Republican barbers and had a little pull out of his pint bottle. But that Ford dealership was in this little town for over 70 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's gone. And it's gone now.
I actually have a Ford Taurus that I inherited from my mom about 15 years ago. It has 150,000 miles on it, 1989. So I guess it'll be a classic in about a year.
And, you know, that was a great car. And they tried, you know, it was interesting. So, again, back to marketing, Preston. Ford tried to upgrade the Taurus, and they changed the name of it to the Ford 500.
Okay.
I guess to compete with the Chrysler 300 and the fact that all the German cars have number names instead of being named, you know, the Family Cruiser or Vista Cruiser. I remember those. Country Squire wagons. They renamed it the Ford 500, and the car-buying public said, no, it's not. It's a Taurus. Put the Taurus badge back on it. We want it to be a Taurus.
Right.
And they had to. And it's a lovely car. Got a nice, strong little V6 engine in there. But see how easy it is? See, there I go.
I actually took some, I had the privilege to be able to take some road trips in that car. And I went to the Southwest, discovered this gigantic meteor crater in Arizona. I guess it hit about 40,000 years ago, and it was fascinating. It was interesting to stand at its rim. It's massive. And I also went to the Northwest, and they kind of felt like Vision Quest in a way, almost.
And I can imagine.
I had these wonderful like CDs playing from this group called Sounds True. They broadcast people like Houston Smith, the theologian, and Terrence McKenna, who's done a lot of interesting work on shamanism. More recently, they've been publishing people like Eckhart Tolle. I don't know if you know him. He does like The Power of Now. I'm kind of skeptical of him. I noticed Oprah did a big series with him, interviewed him, you know, had him on the webcam, and then Sean Hannity was also recommending his work. And so I kind of went back to some of his work with a more critical eye. And I saw a lot about what he's saying that was very convenient to the elite. You know, don't worry about the past or the future, and don't be against things. It was kind of like the sermons you'd hear around Guatemalan City garbage dumps when the CIA-funded theologians would go and preach to the poor about, you know, don't worry about this life. You know, heaven will set you up later. Don't organize whatever you do, and don't resist the elite. They understand people's power. And they try to neutralize it in a variety of ways. And I don't completely want to condemn Eckhart Tolle's work either. I think there are moments when he's helpful, but I'm suspicious. And especially if Sean Hannity is recommending him to his audience.
Oh, it's over. Sorry, I don't mean to be a closed-minded ass or anything, but no, it's over.
Likewise. But that's another part of the progressive movement, though, as well. I mean, those other people I mentioned, I mean, they're these multicultural, you know, people, you know, encouraging people to explore all kinds of different faiths. People like Ram Dass. I don't know if you know his history, but he was a, you know, very straight-laced Harvard professor in psychology, and then he took some psychedelic mushrooms and became a very different person and went to India for a while, studied Hinduism.
Right.
Brought that very interesting, again, in his own flawed ways, and he'd be the first one to say it, you know, he's got his own issues, but made an effort to bring back this ancient knowledge, a different way of thinking about life, death, illness.
Right, and anybody who's ever read, with regard to scientific applications, anybody who's ever read the Tao of Physics or the Dancing Wu Li Masters or any of those, it is non-scientific and scientific at one and the same time, because it's the problems are primarily semantic and linguistic. Attempts to express what we understand in Western concepts as mathematical ideas, trying to express them linguistically, and it doesn't. It may work okay in Sanskrit, but not so much in English. But to try to pull those concepts out. That's one of those Hamlet moments, you know, where there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophies, Horatio. Yeah, without a doubt.
Great. You know, discussions of things like the soul. And I think some on the left are kind of aren't into that so much. But represented.
Well, look at the basic dimensions of the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan.
Okay.
You can't get to, as if I understand everything correctly, and I don't want to, you know, go running off down Eric von Däniken Road or anything. But you can't get to those. You can't build that pyramid without pi. And yet, the conventional wisdom is that none of the peoples who were involved in that construction possess the mathematical concept of pi, because we ascribe it to the ancient Greeks at a relatively late phase of their development.
Yeah, you know, and all these advanced astrologies and understandings of the planets and the motions of the stars and you know, the mystery of how do they accomplish that without something like the space shuttle, and how they do their own version of time travel, kind of out of body sorts of things that, you know, I don't know, interesting things to explore, that's for sure.
And, you know, I don't just discount anyone who ascribes to these things. I simply try to maintain a distance, if you will,
yeah,
between that and provable science. I can't tell somebody, I don't believe in interpreting dreams for the most part, because, you know, your dreams are a function of your own brain. But yet psychologists and researchers say that there are, and, you know, Jung was a big one for this, that there are archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, the Freud himself. I don't know. I simply do not know. But I think that human experience is the relevant factor in all of this. And what people do with their lives as a result of the impact that it makes on them.
Yeah. I guess the Australian Aborigines have their, you know, their dream time concept.
John tried to straighten me up on that a little bit. I thought it was something that wasn't. But it goes into their cosmology and their creation mythology. And of course, you know, the Popol Vuh of, and the what are the miracle twins or something of the Maya cosmology. Literally the red-headed stranger that seems to appear in much of South and Central American mythology, when, you know, red-headed strangers just didn't exist.
And it's so interesting too how different regions have their, you know, their particular flavors, but the similarities that you find in some of these things, you know, some of the Celtic, you know, mythology and their symbolism and stuff, is the artwork, it's very similar to other stuff we find in South America.
Well, go figure out the Olmec heads there on the Caribbean coast of Mexico. Those people don't look like anybody who lived there, and yet they are very, very honest human representations.
Yeah.
There are those giant Olmec heads. There are people that appear decidedly Caucasian. There are people with decidedly African features, people with Polynesian features, and generally people who don't look like the people who live there. And these were just dreamed up.
Right. You know, speaking on this topic of the kind of new age, and again, what does that mean? And I think sometimes there's been some unnecessary, you know, division between people who are kind of pursuing, you know, spiritual and psychological endeavors, and people who are more intently political. But I think there's a lot of overlap and a lot of points at which, you know, a lot of useful collaboration can go on. And I noticed, like, someone like Deepak Chopra sometimes is dismissed by friends of mine, too, as kind of a huckster or whatever. For me, he's kind of been hit and miss. But, you know, I feel that way about myself.
Yeah, well, anybody who gets it all right, is probably being all right all the time is a function of the perceiver and not the presenter.
Right. Most recently, though, I don't know if you caught this, but Deepak was being interviewed by a lot of people after the Mumbai attacks, and he talked about that sort of terrorism, but he said it's important to keep in mind that, you know, there's another sort of terrorism that comes from 20,000 feet in the sky, and, you know, from air forces of nation states. And he got a lot of flack for that, of course, but I think he's exactly right. And I thought, you know, good
it's,
on
it. Truly, it is in the eye of the beholder. The bomb looks a lot different from 20,000 feet up than it does on at ground zero with the darn thing coming at you.
Mm-hmm. And notice how with all the bombs that we've dropped, you know, we could all, our video people could only make it to the car bombs, to the explosions the other side caused, and the screaming and the bodies.
Oh, there's clear. Yeah, there are empirical decisions, not empirical, but there are decisions made as to good bombs versus bad bombs. There was data that came out today as to how much money went into the election cycle. And I think it was, it was measured in billions. And it was all money that was pumped into the election cycle on our side by folks going $5, $10, $25, $50, $100 at a time. And it was given to, organizations that are supposedly licensed to use our airwaves for the public good, who do it instead to line their pockets.
Yep. Yep. To, you know, someone this morning on a radio show said something like, you know, we don't manufacture anything here anymore. But actually last year we sent out $38 billion worth of armaments. A lot of it subsidized, you know, countries that are apparently too poor to provide social services and food and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe that should be modified to, we don't make anything but death here anymore.
It's a warfare state, and it's a shame. But again, it can be different. We have it in our past, and, you know, certainly even now, we still have our contributions that we're making to global society, especially among these kind of social entrepreneurs and NGOs. And
well, I'm looking for a beautiful thing to happen. You know, I'm not a morning creature at all, Preston, but I'm going to get up at an insane hour, at least for me, considering when my day usually ends. I'm going to get up at an insane hour and drive down for a seminar on dismantling racism tomorrow. It will take up my day tomorrow. I won't be on the air tomorrow night. And then it'll take up half of my day on Thursday. And it's going to be some of the best spent hours I will have spent in quite some time. I know that going in. Because without even necessarily knowing what the content or the agenda is going to be, I have a feeling I'm going to be challenged and I'm going to come away with my little head swirling. At least if it goes like I expect it to and like I hope it does, then I will come away that way. I'll come out of there blown away with new ideas to put in practice and new ways of looking at the world.
And I'm sure you'll be able to challenge them, you know, to remind people of the, you know, white Anglo suffering in Appalachia. You know what I mean?
Something sure. I have more kinship within my bloodline. I have more kinship with someone who has great-grandparents who chopped cotton in Alabama than I do with the plantation owner. Because, you know, my forebears weren't even paid in American money.
Your grandparents were in Alabama?
Well, no, my grandparents were here in West Virginia, and my great-grandparents. But the ones who worked in the mines were paid in scrip. They lived in houses that the company let them live in, no different, not much different from the idea behind slave quarters.
Yeah.
They couldn't leave town if they wanted to leave town. They were told when they would go to church, when they would go to work, and with whom they would associate. The violation or breach of any of those commands would result in unemployment, starvation, and death for their family.
You know, wage slavery instead of...
Yeah, and it wasn't even a wage, because again, I reiterate, they were paid in company scrip. They weren't paid. They weren't paid in. They were not paid in legal tender of the United States of America.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
And they were not permitted to shop anywhere but the company store.
Yep.
In many ways, the coal company concept was expanded into the current consumerism of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost Walmart's kind of work.
Bingo.
Working that system. Ludlow, Colorado. The coal company there was doing something similar with the script and the company store. And there's that old spiritual, that song, Sold My Soul to the Company Store, right?
Yeah, the 16 tons.
16 tons, yeah, that's right.
Another day older and deeper in debt. And, you know, it was a big hit on the charts and everything, but that hit on the charts was a reality for a lot of people who fought and bled and sweated and died.
Right. Right.
And, so I'm looking forward to the challenge that I get going down the road tomorrow. Preston, I got a bunch blinking here, but a wonderful conversation, and I thank you for it, and I hope we will hear from you again.
My pleasure. And just real quickly, one other resource I wanted to mention,
mm-hmm.
A blog, Left in Alabama.
That is a tremendous blog.
Great. Everywhere. We're everywhere, Bob.
I know we are, and you know we're that they Left in Alabama has published some of Loretta Nall's pieces, and of course she's a friend of the program.
Oh, good.
And I've read Left in Alabama on a number of occasions, and it is a wonderful blog.
Right on. Good speaking to you, Bob.
Good talking to you, Preston, and take care, and we'll talk soon. I hope.
You bet.
Bye now. Bye. And let's see if we can keep this rolling. Come on, guys. Somebody's still got to be here. You guys. Well, dadgummit. Gotta have a little patience. This is conversation radio. Because you know my policy. Or at least I hope I've enunciated it clearly enough now. My policy is that because I don't have to deal with any, satellite tones or meet any pre-existing deadlines or anything. When the phones light up all the way across, I will take calls until I have taken all the calls. But just a couple of things to pass along to you. And it's kind of a crappy thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, I brought you the story a couple of weeks ago that was not very widely reported. Of the young man, the man, 43 years old, I think his name was Gerritsen, who was playing "I'm Gonna Get You" with his 3-year-old son when he got him by blowing him across the room with the shell that he didn't know was in the shotgun. It's happened again. The Dateline from a blog called The Dreamin' Demon, dated yesterday, December the 15th. Dateline, Chapmanville, West Virginia, which is in Logan County, West Virginia. Something bad happened in Brent David Spencer's head on Wednesday night past. His wife Christy was at work. He was at home with their son, 3-year-old Kagan, another 3-year-old. Sometime that evening, Spencer, 29, shot his son in the head with a .22 caliber firearm. Then he took the toddler outside and laid him on the ground on the family's carport. When Christy's dad drove her home from work, she found her baby on the ground, barely breathing. Kagan Spencer died at the hospital the next morning. The blogger asks, was Brent Spencer insane? Was he drugged out of his gourd and unable to form a coherent thought? To all appearances, the filicide of Kagan Spencer looks like premeditation. Brent shot the child from about 5 feet away, leaving an entrance wound just above the preschooler's left eye. When Kagan's mother and grandfather pulled into the drive, they called 911 to report that it looked like Kagan had fallen down and had a severe head injury, and of course, Brent Spencer initially did nothing to change their minds, but within moments of assessment, it became clear that little Kagan had been shot, and his father appears to have been the only person in the home with him at the time. The family doesn't know what the hell happened. Kagan's grandparents say that Brent seemed like a good guy. They have no idea why he would shoot Kagan, much less leave him outside to die. That said, Spencer apparently has a lengthy history of DUI and alcohol-related stupidity dating back at least 9 years. The charge? Wednesday night, Brent Spencer was charged with child neglect causing serious bodily injury. Later, when the child died, the charges were upgraded to murder. Being held without bond at a local regional jail. It is from Raleigh County to Logan County. But it's not just West Virginia, no matter what this one particular blog reader commenter says. What's wrong? I'll tell you what's wrong with this one. He's in West, by God, Virginia, and out of his mind. Probably inbred. I went to college in West Virginia and have been through Chapmanville before. Nada. Nothing. Ghost town. Of course, Mom was working while he was home, supposed to be tending to his own child. Bored out of his mind. Look at him. Crazy. Has no friends. Who knows? People do not point guns at their kids, especially loaded. If I'm pointing a gun at someone, it's to shoot them, not play around. That person who wrote that is as big an idiot as he alleges exists in West Virginia. This isn't about crazy hillbillies or idiot West Virginians, and you can't lay it off on meth or crack. This is just one thing. And you know what's coming, and you know what it is. This is another installment payment on America's deal with the devil and firearms. Because Kagan Spencer was not murdered. He was sacrificed. He was sacrificed on an altar. An altar that the NRA spends billions to uphold. Kagan Spencer was a blood sacrifice to the demonic cult that has grown up around our fascination with the tools of death. It was a 12-gauge shotgun in the case of the young Garrettson boy in Raleigh County. It was a .22-caliber firearm. I don't know if it was a rifle or a pistol. It doesn't make clear. In the case of Kagan Spencer. And to write it off as, well, there's something wrong because something bad happened in Brent David Spencer's head. No, by God, something wrong happened in Brent David Spencer's hand. But for the NRA, for the fine folks at Remington, Winchester, Smith & Wesson, Sturm, Ruger, Taurus, Heckler & Koch, Sig Sauer, Walther, Mauser, For the People's Chinese Red Army workers chained to tables making AK-47s, nothing is wrong. Nothing is wrong at all. Because for all of those, these are cost-benefit analysis, free market accounting moments. Because the free market in firearms in this country is worth a Raleigh County 3-year-old boy's life, and it's worth a Logan County 3-year-old boy's life. I don't have the will to be sarcastic or be an ass about this. I'm just sick of it. Sick and heartbroken with it. Tired of it. A little late for praying. But if you want to remember someone, remember Kagan Spencer. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. Wouldn't it be nice if everybody had a gun? Because nobody gets shot because everybody have a gun.
I know. I know. Hard to stomach, ain't it?
No. I like that song that played on Mike Malloy's show.
I know. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, you were talking about Jimmy Carter earlier in the Baptist. He left the Southern Baptist.
Yeah.
And he went to another type of Baptist, which my uncle was a part of. And these Baptists are so liberal, it's almost like a Unitarian. I never believed that there was such a liberal.
I may have to find that bunch.
Yeah, I forgot their name, the name of it.
Well, I know hereabouts they'd probably be run out of town on a rail.
Yeah, my uncle goes to one of their churches in Hendersonville, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe they're not too conservative there.
Well,
everything going okay?
Everything's going good. Hoping it doesn't ice up tonight. It's been rainy here all day. I don't want anything to interfere with the trip tomorrow morning.
Yeah, I just got through driving south of Fort Worth, Texas. I guess I drove about 35 miles, and it was like 29 degrees, and it was lightly raining, so that's not too good conditions for overpasses.
No, not at all. So you're nowhere near Corpus Christi yet.
No, I'm headed that way.
Be a while getting there.
I find that it's not Corpus Christi I'm going to. I think it's called Freeport.
Oh, okay.
Freeport, Texas. Shoot.
Okay.
Well, I'm driving around in my old vehicle now, and I have an Alabama tag on it. I was thinking that I need to make me a bumper sticker. It has like Shelby across it, and then has a circle around it, a line through it.
Oh, that'd be good. Maybe Shelby on one side and Sessions on the other.
Yeah, maybe Shelby Sessions on one and then the line through it. I might make one out of maybe some duct tape or something, because Alabama's got a pretty bad name now, I think.
Yeah. Well, this is economic warfare. Pure and simple.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, I tell you what, you stay safe out on the highway, Alan. And we'll look, how's Lula doing?
Oh, she's doing pretty good. She's sitting today. I just took her for a walk. Yeah, I was debating whether to call her Tallulah or Lula.
Well, Tallulah is a good Alabama name.
Yeah, or a Louisiana name, maybe.
Well, no, Tallulah Bankhead was the famous daughter of an Alabama senator.
Okay, I'm gonna have to go back and read my history on that part.
And she was quite the character in her own right.
Okay.
But yeah, I had an email after the show last night talking about your standard poodle there, and the writer did David in Tennessee did confirm that Travels with Charlie was with a poodle. But he said, he said, standard poodles are great dogs. Just don't get them the frou-frou haircut.
Oh, I won't do that. And the writer I was trying to think about last night was Jack Kerouac. Do you like his writings?
Lord, I love Jack Kerouac. I first read On the Road when I was about 16 years old or 15 years old, and it changed my life.
You remember the part where he was riding? They were riding through the Holland Tunnel in a Hudson automobile, and they're all wrapped up.
Yep.
And he wrote this back in the 50s. He said they look like a bunch of Middle Eastern terrorists.
Huh.
What a coincidence. Yeah, and sure, he said that in the book. You go back.
I'll have to see if I can dig up the book and find out exactly what the passage is, but I remember the scene. It's toward the end of the book, I think.
Yeah. Well, I better let you go. You want to close out the show.
All right, Alan, drive safe, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. Bye now. All right, after what I did to you, you deserve a giggle. And this comes to you courtesy of our buddy Dookie, the webmaster over at morningconstitution.com, picking up where WD40.com left off and doing a hell of a job. Dookie said, wrote, questions that I have for the Secret Service. One, shouldn't you have jumped in front of that shoe? Two, shouldn't you have jumped in front of that second shoe? Three, second shoe equals the one thrown after being removed from foot after the first shoe was thrown. Four, let's say people had 3 feet. Would you have allowed a third shoe to fly unimpeded? 5, while the shoe was in the air, were you like, oh, it's just a shoe? 6, same question about the second shoe. 7, do you think this is funny? Throw a shoe at me once, shame on you. You can't throw a shoe again. 8, is there not protection training for lunatics launching objects? 9, let's say there isn't training for that, but do they tell you that if someone does throw or shoot something to be on the alert in case they want to repeat this behavior? 10, where were you? And I don't think this is so much about dear leader, but about the man coming into the office. And I thought about some of that as well. And oddly enough, of course, everything, you know, it's not 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon anymore. It's, you know, 2 degrees of Monty Python. And when I saw this, this posting from Dookie at morningconstitution.com, I immediately thought of John Cleese in that ever so authoritarian, British military uniform marching, striding up and down in front of the recruits screaming, and what if he comes at you with a banana? George W. Bush has reduced the American reputation to the subject matter of a Monty Python skit. And if that's not enough to close the program, I don't know what is. So thank you very, very much for all of your participation, your emails. By the way, an email in from our pal Kate in regard to the kind words that Ed said. Mother Jones, holy boop, what a compliment. My cheeks are warm, grinning here. Signed, Kate from all over. Thanks, Kate. Ed'll be tickled to hear that. So thank you, everyone. And like I said, no show tomorrow night. I'll be a rerun. Mark Levine and Guy James will, however, be live, so make sure you tune in for those. And all of our thanks, as ever, go out to our IT professional, Peter Godbold, to our chief engineer, John Fox, to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. He kept liberal talk alive on the Internet starting about 2002 with the White Rose. And he's a big part of why we are here today. A reminder that we are listener-funded, listener-supported, and we need all of the support that you can spare, because it's getting rougher and rougher and rougher to see the top of the hole that we more or less have dug for ourselves. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, coalriverwind.org, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you.
Fellow Americans. what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show. Yes, the one and only, I don't know the only, but the one for sure, Guy James. And it is a pleasure to have all of you with me this afternoon. We hope to have a informative and entertaining program for you this afternoon. I don't know for sure what we'll concentrate on today. Today's going to be one of those helter-skelter days, I think. I'm not sure, but it just could turn into that. I don't know. Lots of news, but nothing earth-shattering, I suppose, if it weren't for the shoe incident. Oh, my. Oh, my. I don't know. I'll talk about that in just a minute or two. We are coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida. Good to have all of you along with us this afternoon. And before I go any further, I want to thank Eric and John and Carolyn and Scott and Maura. You got that? Eric, John and Carolyn, Scott and Maura. Thanks to all of you for responding to something I had mentioned on the program. Thank you so very, very much. Yes, we are coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida. It's a lovely day, about 78 degrees, and the sun is shining and all that, blah, blah, blah. You get tired of hearing all that. That is why the roads are choked with people right now, because we have nice weather and a lot of other people don't. And I don't know. It's one of those things when it comes to this time of year, you don't, if you're one of the locals here, like myself, you don't do a lot of traveling around. You really don't. You don't go into town as much as you might. You just kind of stick close to home because, frankly, it's a bit difficult getting around. It really